Hey, to answer your question the other day you sent, I didn't mean to blow you off, but you asked about the fingerprints on the rifle and who said what. You know, I found six different versions of the same thing.
Yeah.
Day's testimony, Cunningham's testimony, Livingston in his book, First Day Evidence. They all said that they're contradicting each other. One said like Day said, yeah, I lifted a print off the stock. And then the FBI says, well, I never found any lift tape off there. Livingston says, yeah, he lifted a tape, and a blatant print. So that, I guess my point is, there's no definitive answer if there was a print ever lifted off of the damn thing or not. Because he never had it long enough to even actually examine it, supposedly.
Yeah. Guys, I just want to let people know we have to focus our minds a little bit on something. We know that the records are supposed to be were postponed for release until October, but in the process of recommending to the president to do the postponement, the archivist indicated that he had asked the agencies that had withheld that requested further postponement to advise them, the archivist, by April 26th if they're going to want to have further postponement. So the actual deadline for us, for our purposes, is not October to focus. It is April 26th. And so what I'm doing is I've drafted a letter to Carolyn Maloney, who's my congressperson. So that's why I'm doing this. She's the chair of the Oversight Committee of the House. And I have basically prepared a brief. Dave, Bill Simpich and Patrick McCarthy are reviewing it for me. And I'm not sure how many people know this, that there were resolutions introduced into both the House and the Senate in October of 2017, urging the president to release the rest of the records. Those resolutions were then passed on to the appropriate committees, one in the House and one in the Senate. So I'm going to be sending a letter out next week to Carolyn Maloney and also the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee. By the way, Grassley was the principal sponsor of that in the Senate. Once the letter goes out, you all should look at if any of your congresspeople are on either the Senate Judiciary Committee or the House Oversight Committee. I'll let you know when this letter goes out, and then you guys should contact your representatives if they're on the committee with a Me Too letter, basically just saying, you know, you support the effort. And what we want to try to do is get them to have a hearing before April 26th to put the pressure on the agencies. Whether they're going to do it or not, I don't know. Maybe we'll get some press out of it. But that's the immediate, that's the date that the archive is set. So we're actually 6 months ahead of the October date.
Okay, Larry. Hey, I just want to break in real quick. I started a little bit later today of doing the intro.
Oh.
But the reason why is because we were having some people show up late, which is cool, you know, but I just want to give everybody a little bit of time before we kicked off. So real quick, this is Crowded JFK, CSI Dallas, presenting The Journey on the Trail of Truth in the Kennedy Assassination. This is our second meeting of this new series, and we're looking at doing this each month for about 90 minutes or so. We're also known to run over from time to time. We've got a spring conference coming up in April that you can find details on projectjfk.com. And there'll be a lot of updates coming here in the next couple of weeks with speakers, a schedule to be able to purchase tickets to that virtual event. It will be hosted on Zoom on a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, starting in, let's see, the exact date is going to be, it'll be Friday, April 30th, and May 1st and May 2nd. And like I say, details will be coming on that here in the future. Also, we're going to have our next meeting next month on the same day, so it'll also be on March 20th. If you want to write that down in your calendars, you will get emails hopefully sooner than what it was this month. But March 20th, 2021 from 1 o'clock in the afternoon until 2:30 Central Standard Time. And this time we're going to run this show a little bit different than what we did last month for those that attended last month's meeting. We've got special guests. Definitely Larry just gave us some information, and anything he'd like to add to that here later on would be great. We always like to hear from Larry. And also Bill Simpage is going to let us, we're going to give him some time to talk about his new project and new book. So like I said, I just want to welcome everybody for taking time out on a Saturday afternoon to keep seeking the truth and keep searching for it. Let's see. Brian, do you have anything you'd like to add to that?
Yeah. We've got – David's uploaded some new photos on our website. And if you're interested, look at our website and go to the Gary Shaw Legacy tab. We've loaded up inside the Carousel Club probably some of the pictures you've never seen before. Still trying to run down who took the pictures. There's some conjecture that Larry – what's his – Armstrong Jack – Ruby's supposedly bartender took some of these photographs. And I was just reading on Dealey Plaza UK, Ian Griggs in an interview of his, and said that he did admit that he was inside the club taking pictures. That was one of his assignments. I don't think I would want to have that evidence in place if I was in there, you know, snuggling up to a waitress or something. But anyway, take a look at the website. David's sharing that now. There are some Bill Boxley photographs in there, from the Garrison investigation. And then there's the, newspaper clippings. Gary gave us a whole bunch of newspaper clippings, of that time. And there's, you can see some of the photographs and the collection data about each one of the photographs. These were used, some of these were used during the HSCA, I think they used some of these photographs. So take a look at those. They're rated M for mature audiences. Some of them are typical, you know, grab pictures, you know, grab screenshots if you can, but anyway, take a look at those. Some of those you may not have ever seen before. Gary got those from multiple sources, Time Magazine, New York Times, as you can see every week. And David, we well recorded, we scanned the actual envelope that the documents came in. And there's
yeah,
some,
like what's up on the screen, like the volume 19, page 34, Armstrong exhibit number 5301-E. Whatever the envelope is, the picture that's inside that is actually going to be just to the right of that. So I try to keep them as close to as order. Everything looked like it uploaded correctly. But these were actually basically Polaroid size negatives. They're not photographs. They were negatives that I scanned in and then, you know, put online. And then let everybody know that this is the Shaw Legacy first page, but when you go to the website, projectjfk.com, you'll see Shaw Legacy up here, and then you click on Shaw Legacy 2, and these are PDFs that you can download. You can download the entire PDF. This is an article, Smoking Gun for the Grassy Knoll by J. Gary Shaw. And if you scroll down past that, you'll see the assassination story part one and part two. Now, what these are is these are actually the scanned newspapers. That was something that Penn Jones Jr. and J. Gary Shaw was giving out in Dealey Plaza. And then because of copyright issues back, you know, way back in the 1960s and 1970s, they were no longer able to pass these out. Well, wow. Gary had one of these in his collection, and I feel for the historical value of it. Now, of course, on the screen here, it's kind of hard to see, but if you download the PDF, you can make the warning as big as you want and read each individual article. So that's why I made these a downloadable PDF. But there's 62 pages of newspaper articles in both of the collections. And
David, can I interrupt? David, can I interrupt you? Gary's trying to chime in, but he's not having any trouble, or he's having trouble. Can you check him?
Yeah, let me see if I can get him added in. Hold on just a sec.
Gary, we're working on it.
Looks like some of the girls wouldn't cut the mustard nowadays.
No. Well, unless you lived in my town, there's a little club that you don't even want to go into. We didn't even go in there as cops because it's kind of scary. Gary,
they had more meat on them in those days.
Yeah. Gary, David's working on it. Hang on.
Good solid Texas girls. Hey, I'll tell you what. I had to explain to my wife what I was doing in New Orleans at one of the you know where I'm going with this, don't you? Was it the show bar? When I walked in there, and my wife said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, there's a barter out there. He wants me to come in and see what's going on." She goes,
"Research."
Well, yeah.
You see him, David?
It was a little bit of undercover research, so that's what I kept telling her.
No, I don't see Gary on the in the waiting room at the moment. So
okay. I'm gonna have him call you. And
okay, yeah, that's fine.
Gary.
Okay.
Gary, go ahead and call David. Okay.
Well, while we're waiting to try to get Gary in, I'm also going to show another quick screen share here. What this is Lulu Press's website, and if anybody has not read the or picked up a copy or ebook of Garrison Magazine, our friend S.T. Patrick with Midnight Rider News Publications puts out a magazine. He just got done doing his sixth magazine that came out February 2nd of this year. But there's a lot of great articles, not just on JFK, but also RFK, MLK, Watergate, different historical articles that are written by fellow researchers, J. Gary Shaw, Brian, Casey, myself, and a whole list of others. But if you go to lulu.com, and then if you would type in like Midnight Rider News Publications or Garrison Magazine, you'll be able to find these. And also our friend David Denton has a book that was put out here. Let me see if I can pull it up. If anybody hasn't gotten it yet,
I'm gonna connect you.
Is Lulu like an Amazon?
It's basically it's a self-publishing website where if you have a book that you write and you want to get it published, this is the place to do it at. Or you know, like us, we do publishing as well. But let me
give him a buzz, and if not, call me back.
Okay.
All right.
Let me see if I can pull up Denton's book. Well, I can't pull it up on the thing. I've got it.
David, Gary's going to call you.
Okay.
He's having a little trouble getting through the join part.
Okay. Hang on just a second. Let me see if I can get in here. Go ahead, Gary. Yeah. Okay. Well, here, I tell you what, just open up Zoom and I'll just give you the, I'll give you the information on how to log in real quick. Just open up Zoom.
Thank you guys for bearing with us on this.
Yeah. Type in the meeting ID code as 810. Five, seven, two, one, four, four, five, five, nine. And then it's going to ask for the passcode on the next screen. Okay, passcode is 311805. That should be it.
You'll
want to show up in the, you'll enter that in, and then I'll be able to admit you into the room. What's your screen say? Okay. Yeah, join the video. Yep, I just clicked you in. Okay, you're with us.
Hey, Dr. Shaw, what are you doing?
Okay, well, it's showing you're still connecting to the audio, so when you want to talk, you'll want to unmute yourself at the bottom of your screen there. It'll take a second for the audio to connect. I'm going to pass you off to Casey here real quick.
Good day, everyone. Hi.
How we doing, Bart?
I'm good, thanks.
Okay, sometimes I couldn't pull up on Lulu Press's website while ago, so I'll just show it into the camera. It's a book by David Ditton, put out by Midnight Rider News, and it says Essays on the Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. But if anybody wants to, pick up this book as well, there's great articles and essays that Professor Ditton wrote. So if anybody wants to grab a new book, that's a book that not a lot of people know they're out there. But like I say, it's on Lulu Press's website. I think most of the ebooks for Midnight Rider News, they're about $9.98 for ebook, or they're under $20 for the print copy. And if you do the ebook, it shows up within about 3 minutes. So far, we don't have Gary's audio up, but let's see. Bill, you're in here now. I'm going to go ahead and turn this over to Bill for a few minutes. Go ahead and, talk as long as you like, Bill, about your new book and what you want to tell us. Right. Make sure you unmute yourself before you start talking, though.
Can you hear David talking? Yeah, hold on. I'm gonna give you back to David. We got two Bill Simpsons up there. That's pretty good.
Bill, we can't hear you, buddy.
Bill, unmute yourself.
Let's see what we got here. Now we're back to one.
Okay, we still can't hear you yet. You might need to power down your device and restart it and come back in on Zoom, and then you should have your audio unmuted at that point. And just so while we've got Bill working on getting his audio fixed, just so I let everybody know, Zoom is kind of a finicky creature. It's one of the best video messaging and or video meeting sites to use. But one thing about Zoom that's kind of touchy is from time to time where just before you start a meeting, it's a great idea to actually do a fresh boot on your computer or tablet or device that you're using. So that way when you come back into Zoom, everything works, your video, your audio. So just before the meetings or the conferences, just do a quick power off and restart your computer or device, and that usually helps out a lot of issues. So, well, we'll just vamp a little bit until Bill comes back in.
Bamp.
Well, bam, you know, we'll keep the show running.
You want to you want to talk about the women in Ruby?
Well, you know,
we get in trouble, no doubt.
Well, Gary would be the expert on that. He was in the Carousel Club at one point.
Oh,
yeah, as a minor, of course.
Now, Gary, your microphone's not unmuted, so let me.
Maybe Dan Storper was there too.
I was with you.
There we go,
amazing.
Gary.
Okay. There's Gary. Hi, Gary.
Hey, Brian.
Bill's coming back in. He's connecting his audio. All right.
Yep. There he is. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, Bill, you there?
I'm here.
All right. Now let's take the show back to Bill for, you know, his time. Go ahead, Bill.
I will not carry on about the John Connolly discussion, which is what we talked about last time. And I'm going to tailor my remarks for this audience because you guys know more about the case than most people. So I'm going to focus on what I think are the tantalizing new leads, if you will, that I didn't expect to find while building up the story of Oswald and his 12 legend makers, if you will. On these legend makers, I'll just say that a number of them are people who handled this file, CIA and FBI people. People like Ann Eggeter at CICIG, people like Ann Goodpasture at Mexico City. And then you got other people like George de Morenschelt and the Paynes. And one thing I did do in my book is I took a very long look at the Paynes. And as I think you'll see with a couple of things I'm going to present in the next 10 minutes, that my thinking on the Paynes is I think that they were asked to keep an eye on Oswald by somebody. Somebody like, probably like, you know, somebody who was Mary Bancroft, Alan Dulles's girlfriend, or somebody who knew Mary and Alan. Because it also seems that Alan was the guy who brought de Morenschelt into the fold with, in terms of helping out the CIA on little tasks. And with that said, you can read the book to get more of that flavor. But there's a very interesting note. It was written right after the assassination, and you can actually see the note in the book, and it looks like it came from Mary Bancroft. I'm going to ask somebody to go to Radcliffe Library and check the typeface and check the language used, but it sure sounds like Mary Bancroft to me. She's got her archives there, which is another good reason for us to be visiting the archives whenever we can. A lot of these archives can now be visited online all around the country for free. I'm getting stuff at the Beinecke Library in Yale right now on some CIA guys. That's fair game. So, you know, there's great research that can be done during COVID you can't do during ordinary times. With that said, I don't know how many people here are familiar with Clifford Chastain. He was literally the barber for both Lee Oswald in Dallas during the summer and fall of 63. And he was also the barber for Bob Odom, who was the Paynes FBI contact. And I'm asking people to keep in mind, you know, that Chastain lived in Irving. This guy was an FBI informant. We know that because he was described as an informant as early as 1950, and he was spying on communists when he worked at the Chancebout Air Company. And, you know, which was pretty sensitive stuff. Cliff was a barber. Cliff was also the mayor and city councilman of Irving for a period in the 70s. So he knew everybody. In fact, he even knew Ruth Payne. He knew what kind of car she drove. And he saw the guy who he recognized as Oswald actually getting out of Ruth's car on one occasion, going to the Hutchinson's Market. And the other thing about Chastain, apart from the fact that him and his barbers all saw a fellow who called himself Oswald 6, 7, 8 times, is that on at least one occasion, he came in with a guy, a young kid, Oswald did, 14 years old, who talked socialism better than Stokely Carmichael, and which did not make the barbers happy. I mean, it was kind of an unforgettable performance. His last performance was right before the assassination, and he wasn't with Oswald that time. Greg Parker did some good thinking about this, and he identified the guy as the one, as being probably being the one student that Ruth Payne had, a young guy named Hootkins, who was wound up becoming an actor in Star Wars. So it's not impossible. This guy Hootkins was working with Ruth and working with Lee and this and that. But, you know, being of a contrary mind, I always try to look at this evidence both ways. And I asked the question, you know, was it really, you know, was it really Oswald? I don't think it was. But if it wasn't Oswald, was it Hootkins? In other words, was Hootkins impersonated as well? There's a number of sightings of this Oswald character in Dallas that I think we all know. I spent a lot of time going through those sightings. I discussed Jack Lawrence, and he's much higher on my radar than I would have put him otherwise. He's a little harder to research. He was not born and bred in the Dallas area. He was only passed through for a couple months. He was a Cuban anti-Castro adventurer and died in West Virginia. But there's a lot on him. And there's a lot on Chasteen. And there's a lot on other people like Paul Barger, who was the Irving police chief, who did some research on Oswald I'll get into before I stop. Do I have another 5 or 10 minutes?
Oh, go ahead, Bill.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't want to – I want to keep it short because I want people to understand the focus of where I'm going with all this. My focus, in a word, is that, you know, I think we've done some great research on Daley Plaza. I think our research on the familial connections and reliability of a number of these people has really been very, very weak. And I hope that I can inspire people to take longer looks at people like Chasteen, who I think is a central figure, not in the assassination, but in understanding Oswald and in understanding these FBI agents and their relationships. And to that end, I want to turn for a minute to another area that I was very surprised to get totally caught up in, which is the days before the assassination, and specifically Paul Rothermel, who was H.L. Hunt's security director. We now have a copy of Rothermel's letter, and I've got this in the book, too. This I'm quoting now largely from the last two chapters, chapter 12 and the epilogue. In those two chapters, I really tried to jam in there the things I didn't, you know, that I thought were good leads, as opposed to the whole fabric of networks around Oswald. And the Rothermel lead is of interest because he was an FBI agent in the past, and he chatted with the FBI all the time. And in that context, Rothermel knew a lot about the chit-chat, he wound up coming in with strong opinions about the fact that he felt something was going to happen in November 22nd, and there was going to be some kind of trouble, some kind of disruption. And in fact, the right wing was planning the disruption. And in fact, a couple of people were arrested at the end of the day for their actions in that regard. And all this goes to say that this ties into the letters, rather the ad that was posted by Larry Schmidt and those people about, wanting Kennedy in Dallas. And specifically, the fact that they thought Kennedy was a bad actor. And I think that they helped shift the focus towards a different aspect of the right wing than was really warranted. And so I think that whole area needs to be looked at because, after all, where was Oswald during the motorcade? We could talk about the Prayer Man battle, of course, for a long time, which is important. But I think whether or not you believe he made it out to the back steps, I think the preponderance of the evidence also shows that he was on the first floor, you know, maybe within earshot of one of the telephones on the second floor. I think he was told to wait out of sight. Everybody else in Dallas is looking at the president, except Oswald. And yet nobody was more interested in politics probably in Dallas then Oswald. So why isn't he right up front during the murder case? He's involved in something, all right, but there's not a particle of evidence to show he's on the sixth floor outside of that one guy who changed his story, the African-American man who had a lot of narcotics problems and was easy to lean on, just like the other African-Americans who I feel were leaned on in their testimony. So I was really struck by that. And now I want to turn to Bardwell Odom in particular, because he was a guy who was the Payne's agent. He was a guy who was getting his hair cut by the same time, the same guy as Oswald. He was a senior criminal specialist, and he was a favorite of the Dallas FBI chief. He was not some flunky. For example, he's all over this case. He's the guy who shows Marguerite the mystery man photo within 24 hours, who Marguerite thought was Jack Ruby. He's the guy who was a veteran in intelligence. He went so far as to claim to Ruth that he'd never known about the Oswald visit to the Dallas FBI office, the one where Oswald dropped off a note for Hostie. I don't believe it. And the reason why is because virtually everybody else in the office knew all about it, and they talked about it among themselves all the time. So Odom, to me, is not a good actor for a number of reasons. That's just one. When Ruth found out that Oswald had actually delivered the note to Hostie, she blurted out Odom's name to the media as her source. And then she calls Odom and apologizes, saying, you know, it's all my fault. It's all my fault. Ruth loved Odom. And so did, Michael Payne. He would call him Bob Odom. The only other person I've ever heard call him Bob is Hostie himself in one of his depositions. If you read Hostie's book, and I want to turn on Hostie, I spent this morning reading about 400 pages on Hostie because his testimony is so problematic. And again, I'm not saying he's part of the assassination, but I'm saying that he knows more than he wants to know. If you read his book of Simon Oswald, he talks about how Odom knew all about how Hostie was ordered to destroy the note. Oswald was brought to the FBI office as soon as Hostie's boss Shanklin heard Oswald was dead. Odom denies every word of Hostie's account, stating that if any FBI agent was involved in destroying evidence, he would not forget it. Well, Odom had a lot to forget about. Odom is a guy you see driving J.C. Day from the book depository to put the rifle, the alleged assassination rifle, into a locked evidence box in Day's fourth floor office at the police department. Odom calls in over the FBI radio channel and a radio tape that's now disappeared in the ether without a trace. We then see Odom stationing himself as a guard in the lobby of the Texas Theater, watching Oswald be frog marched away. Curiously, Odom's standing right inside the theater near FBI counterintelligence officer Robert Barrett and Dallas Captain Pinky Westbrook. Like Odom, Barrett's also told his share of whoppers. Barrett has told a variety of stories about whether or not he's looking for bullets with Buddy Walters in Daly Plaza in the moments after the assassination. I think he was there, and that's a longer story. He's gone to great lengths to hide his presence there. And it's very problematic. Mark Oakes could tell you all about it. Similarly, when Westbrook was videotaped holding a wallet similar to Oswald's at the tip of death scene, Barrett claims that Westbrook told him that the wallet had both Oswald and Hiddell's ID in it. But then, and I believe this for years, and the reason I'm so pissed off is because I found documents in the 1980s, newspaper articles, where Barrett tells the news media that a card with O.H. Lee was found in the wallet. And other times, Barrett says it was Detective Westfall that found the wallet. And then, now he says it was Westbrook. This is not the kind of thing you forget. Barrett, I think, has been spreading disinformation into this case. And I think this is one of the reasons we've had such difficulty research in this case, is because we've relied on whoppers told to lead us astray. And, you know, we could have, that's a longer discussion as well. But Odom and Barrett, I think in particular, told lies designed to confuse everyone about the key events surrounding the assassination. By 1:51, the Dallas radio transcript shows Jerry Hill and his buddies are en route to headquarters with Oswald. Hill's with Luke Mooney on the sixth floor when they claim to find the Mannlicher hulls that supposedly match the rifle that Odom escorted to the evidence room. I think Odom is busy here. Then you see Odom showing up at the searches on Ruth Payne's home. Ruth felt that Marina must have known that Lee went to Mexico based on the materials from Mexico that she and Odom allegedly found while going through Marina's dresser drawers. Without a warrant, I might add, Ruth felt fine about letting him have the place, and Odom felt fine about not doing all this without a warrant. On November 22nd, you can see a ring, for example, on Oswald's left hand, which later disappears. It might be his wedding ring, but even if it's his marine ring, it still doesn't really matter because the chain of custody, these rings are hotly contested. This one researcher did a great job talking about Marina's two contradictory statements. On 12/3/63, she says, I saw Oswald's wedding ring left behind when I woke up that morning, even though it was on his hand the previous evening. But she didn't see the ring on her dresser that morning. She only saw it after the police arrived that afternoon, and that's well documented. And then Marina made a couple other contradictory statements. She said that she called Ruth Payne and told her about finding the ring on her dresser. That's important because that's right about the time Marina's taken into custody by the Secret Service. But when Ruth testifies to the Warren Commission, she tells them that Odom was the one who asked her to find the wedding ring. He asked Ruth if she had any idea where it might be. Ruth finds a ring in the first place she looked, in the little teacup that's from her grandma. And then the National Archives goes through all this, and they can't find any record of any ring being turned over to the FBI. But yet, Marina says that the federal government had possession of it for years and returned it to her years later. This is all very problematic. What I can tell you, to kind of wrap up here, is that Ruth and Michael regularly spoke to Odom. Marina did not. There's a picture on 11/23 where she's telling Odom with a translator, I won't talk to you. And this gets her nothing but, 85 interviews. Larry Schnapp has counted them, where they're just putting the heat and just putting the heat and just putting the heat on her to get deported. When all this has settled, Wally Heitman, who's Odom's boss in terms of, they're the two big Spanish speakers over there. Wally gets control of the evidence. Wally's the guy who changes the listing of the items found from a Minox camera to a Minox light meter. Odom is the guy who plays games with the magic bullet. It's his declaration that challenges what we've documented pretty tightly to show that the FBI signatures simply are not on the evidence like they should be. There's a memo from Odom that supposedly clears this up, but then they take, and Gary finally buttonholed Odom before he died, and Odom goes, I didn't write this declaration. This is not my declaration at all. To make a long story short, Odom's a very bad actor. His brother, I hate to do guilt by association, his brother was deeply involved in the Venezuelan embassy right during a period that we were trying like crazy to overturn the Venezuelan government and scare Jack Kennedy with of the finding of rifles in Venezuela that were supposedly being smuggled by Castro's people. Jack Kennedy saw Helms before he died, and that was in the White House. So the Odoms really deserve very close scrutiny. And one last story I've got, if we have time for it.
Yeah, go ahead, Bill.
All right. This is a story that really troubles me, but it also fascinates me. The question is the Ruth Payne, Michael Payne phone call, where they're chatting over the phone, supposedly, and a third party who we don't know who's the third party is, the Payne say to each other, we both know who is responsible. And so I thought for years this came from a wiretap. But I think this story was entirely made up by an intelligence operative. This operative was either a telephone repairman or gave the story to the repairman. And he passed on the Planet story to Irving Police Chief Paul Barger, who's still alive at 95. And I'm trying to get somebody to interview Barger or his family about this story, because Barger's never coughed the whole story up. I think this operative passed the story on to Barger with the hope of linking Oswald to the communist menace and instigating an attack on Cuba. When LBJ and his team made it clear to Henry Wade, the DA, and Earl Warren that rumors about communist involvement had to be squelched, all of a sudden you see Barger's report getting buried. Why would you be burying this report? This is some of the most important evidence there is on the face of it. Now, what did Ruth say? Well, she initially denies it when she's first confronted with it. But there's a conversation, you know, in a phone log on 11/22 between her and Michael. So she had a problem denying that the phone call happened. So by the 70s, now she's saying that the conversation referred to the American right-wing forces that were creating the hostile environment. What does Jim Hostie say in his book? He says the phone call happened on the night of November 22nd, but he says it was between Lyman Payne and his son, Michael. Well, we don't have any records showing that at all. Hostie goes on to say they didn't take it too seriously because they assumed that Lyman, who after all was a Trotskyist, was blaming the powers that be and reminding Michael that Stalin's people killed Trotsky. Hostie doesn't offer any documentary evidence on this. Well, what does Barger say, the Irving PD chief? He says that the call was between Ruth's phone and Michael's work phone, overheard by a telephone repairman. But again, we've got the phone log for that November 22nd call. There's no phone call for November 23rd between these two numbers, only November 22nd. So then you hear Barger saying, well, it could have been the 22nd as well as the 23rd. And he thinks the information came from telephone company sources. So both Ruth and Michael tell the Warren Commission several times that the phone call happened. Michael and Ruth said no details were talked about in this conversation. They didn't know the details. So given Oswald's fraught relationship with the FBI, Oswald's arrest, which it didn't happen until 3 o'clock, and this phone call, according to their testimony, is at 1 o'clock, and it's corroborated by one of Michael's workers. So Oswald's arrest didn't give Payne any more reason to be sure about Oswald's involvement than he did at 1 o'clock, much less for him to say, we both know who is responsible. That's what it keeps coming back to, is this comment, we both know who is responsible. So then in 76, you guys will laugh at this. There's a Dallas Times Herald article written to refute the allegations of a wiretap on the Payne's residential line. And it never has been proven there was a wiretap. I got to say that. But who gets involved? Hugh Ainsworth. He interviews Paul Barger. And Barger goes, well, I know the source of the report, and it was a telephone repairman who by chance, now this is what Barger's told, you know, but Barger's a detective, you got to wonder. He's told by the repairman that due to some mechanical difficulties, he's checking out the line and inadvertently listens in on the conversation. Barger doesn't ID the man, of course. Barger adds he does not believe the FBI had any wiretap. If they did, after all, they wouldn't be asking me for what happened. So the phone call is not denied, but Barger claims, and I think it's proven, that he is the source. It's T4 that's mentioned in the FBI records. Now, to wrap this up once and for all, what I find fascinating is that when the FBI examines the records for Michael's phone number, it's initially an unpublished number for Bell Helicopter. But that's kind of odd because he was actually working at a research lab in Arlington, 10 miles away. And he's one of the few employees with a key to the lab. And then another memo says, Mike Payne and George Johnson, another guy who works there, give access to the plant to telephone company employees. To me, what this indicates is that Mike Payne was assigned by Bell Helicopter to be its liaison to the telephone company. So the operatives to the phone company, and these people are spooks, believe me. I can tell you a lot about this line of country. These operatives at the phone company had a personal relationship with Michael Payne. This is who's supposedly listening to the phone call, right? This is what Barger's telling us. I believe the Paynes told someone, maybe Mike's mother, maybe Mary Pancroft, they keep an eye on the Oswald. They got in way over their head. The whole story about the Pangs knowing who's responsible was made up and part of a plan to point the assassination on Castro's Cubans, and we'll never know who was cooking this up, but it was somebody who was close to Mike as a liaison, I think. This story is a spare part linking Oswald to a larger communist plot that in the end was not used. As we all know, we remember how LBJ told Dick Russell, we got to get this out of the arena where they're testifying that Khrushchev and Castro did this and that and kick us into a war and kill 40 million Americans in an hour. So Paul Berger's still out there. And if we can find him or his family, I'm sure they know a lot about this story. That's the last couple chapters of my book. There's a lot of new stuff. I urge you guys to take a hard look at it, especially these last two chapters.
Bill, do you have a picture of Odom that you could share?
I'm thinking. The short answer is I do.
Okay.
I would give me a couple minutes to cough it up. That's
okay. The reason I'm asking is that there's that series of photographs taken by William Allen outside the book depository when Day comes out with the rifle. There's a man in a plaid coat with a burr haircut, glasses that walks with him out of sight.
I think that's Odom.
Really? That's why it's.
I think that's Odom. I'm seeing if I put the picture in my book here.
What's the name of your book, by the way? You haven't mentioned.
The name of the book is The 12 Who Built the Oswald Legend.
It's online. Anybody that
great picture of Odom with Marina on November 23rd. I will pass around hopefully before the day is over here.
I'm sharing the screen right now. If you go to maryferrell.org's website, you'll be able to find The 12 Who Built the Oswald Legend. Pardon me. Hold on. My dog is really needing me. Sorry about that. Technical difficulty. But the 12 Who Built the Oswald Legend by Bill Sempage, published online here at Mary Farrell Foundation. And this is where you can read Bill's book.
And one last thing I want to say about the book is it was almost an exercise in instant typing. I mean, yeah, I had to do a lot of research, but I'm telling you guys, there is so much in the materials that we have not mulled over sufficiently. Even with our good work in our magazines and on our websites, it's literally lying out there. A lot of the times I just found myself typing directly into my computer from what I'm reading. So it sure beats reading, you know, social media. That's all I can tell you.
Yeah.
I concur.
Okay. Well, we're at the 1 o'clock or a 1 hour mark here. So I'm going to cut in real quick and throw something in here. If you, let me share the screen here. For people that don't know, that would like to know, we do have on the Project JFK website, the, what is called the Help Our Cause section. And it's not to put money in the three of ours pocket. What this is, what this button was put on the website for is the website is, has, and always will be a free website to go to get information. We're not obviously making any type of money off of, researchers or, document the stuff that we, you know, put onto the website, but in order to help cover operating costs of the website, these meetings that will, you know, that are monthly meetings that are free. The only time that we actually, you know, divvy money up, if anything's left over, is after our conferences or presentations, DVDs, and books that we sell. But this is a way for people to go online and help donate to the cause. So if anybody would like to do that, we would greatly appreciate it. And then there'll be a section right below this that is our sponsors. So if you happen to sponsor the website and want to help us out by, you know, continuing our efforts, your name goes up on the website and doesn't say how much money you've actually donated, but it does put it up there so that way people can see that we do have sponsors and people that want to, you know, continue having us do what we do. I know a lot of websites that are out there, but ours is unique in the fact that, you know, we do things that, some other websites do not do. So, all the other websites, not say anything bad about them. Just, you know, we're trying to do our thing of helping the research community. And if anybody would like to donate, they're more than welcome to do so. So.
Are you guys a 501c3?
What's that?
Are you a 501c3?
No, actually, we're not right now. We've been checking into that, but yeah, we're right now just kind of doing everything that we do, we self-fund. So, you know, having Zoom meetings, the website costs, we pay for that stuff out of our pocket. And we're more than glad to do that, and we will continue doing that, but, you know, every little bit helps. So, you know, if anybody would like to donate, they're more than welcome to do so.
And do you have a webpage?
Yeah, if you go to the projectjfk.com website and scroll down on the homepage, it shows the Help Our Cause section. And like I say, it's a PayPal donate button, so you can donate from PayPal, any of your credit cards, you know, MasterCard, Visa, Discover, American Express. I hate to throw out the quote-unquote e-beg or pass the plate around, but like I say, whatever we get helps us out by, you know, continuing to buy equipment for scanning. It helps pay for the website, you know, things of that nature. So if anybody would like to donate, yeah, please do. And let's see. Larry, did you have something else you wanted? I remember there was some stuff you talked about at the beginning of our show. Was there some more stuff that you wanted to talk about?
No, I just wanted to follow up on that. By the way, I've been working with Russ Baker. He found Dr. Porto. He's in a nursing home. So we're going to try to speak to him to try to get him to come on the record about the temple wounds. I'll let you guys know once the letter is ready to go out, and then I'll provide you a list of the members of the committees, and if anyone on this call or you know anyone that is a constituent of any of those representatives, then we need to start creating this groundswell of support, and we need to figure out a media strategy to highlight this request, since Congress has two resolutions that are still good. They're sitting in committee. You know, clearly it's something to try to put some pressure on Congress to at least hold hearings, and hopefully that will put pressure on the agencies, because, as I said, they're supposed to let the archivists know by April 26th if they intend to ask for further postponements.
Hey, Larry?
Yeah.
This is Dan. I just have a question. I was talking with Libby about this, and she was saying that it may involve, you know, you may have to ask not just Congress, but the Senate.
Yes. Yes.
So writing your congressman and senator.
Yes. The Senate Judiciary Committee, actually, so for some reason, that committee is more active during Sunshine Week than the House Committee. But Grassley, when he was chair of the Judiciary Committee, he was one of the sponsors, and there was a Republican House Representative Jones. He's the one that died, I guess, sometime last year. But he had a great statement. I'm going to give the list of both. So the first letter is going to Maloney because she's my representative. I don't have a senator that's on the Judiciary Committee, but we'll, you know, hopefully we can find someone that is a representative, is a constituent, but clearly we need to do that, both of them.
And you think the focus should just be on the Judiciary Committees? Even if you have a senator, they can't influence the Judiciary?
Well, I mean, ultimately, so the committees, from what I understand, and I'm not an expert on Congress, but from what I've been reading, like I've been looking at the House rules, and the committee chairs are supposed to give Pelosi their plans for hearings for the year so that they can make sure they schedule to have time available. So presumably, it's going to go to, you know, Schumer in the Senate, I guess, ultimately has to approve it. But they have to come out of the committee chairs. So the first thing is to get the committee members to pressure the chair to get them to agree to do this, and then it has to go then to the either Pelosi or Schumer to sign off. So, but we'll, let's, first things first is I'm going to, the big news was I thought we could, this is something for October, and it's really April, because we want to try to get some pressure before these agencies notify the archive and say, hey, we still need more time. We still want further postponement for national security. And they're supposed to provide clear and convincing evidence that this posts, that the document on a document by document basis poses, you know, raises national security claims, and that those claims outweigh the public interest. And there's been a number of, laws passed and reports enacted or adopted, and hearings held by Congress since the JFK Act, which all go towards further transparency. And Obama issued a number of executive orders urging, you know, the executive agencies and departments to basically use a presumption of openness. So I'm also thinking about saying, to the extent, you know, can we argue that maybe some of these other laws have sort of surpassed the JFK Act in one respect or another? You know, that's another argument. But one step at a time is I'm going to try to finalize the letter this week to get it out. I'll circulate it to David and Brian and Casey. Then we can identify who are constituents of the various representatives of both the Senate and the House committees. And obviously Schumer is my senator, one of my senators, but we just want to start organizing an effort to get, and we need a media piece of this as well. It's a twofold thing. The first thing is for Congress to hold a hearing, but within that context of the hearing in compliance with the JFK Act. And within the context of holding a hearing, it then kind of brings within it this upcoming deadline about, you know, the further records that have been released. Does anyone know what the precise or the approximate number of records that are being withheld? I've seen different estimates.
It's about 35,000 when you include the partials.
Okay.
Real quick, guys, I want to throw something in here. Anytime that you have something that you want to get out to, other than just when you send out emails, we have a blog section on our website. So if there's something that you want to have the research community see, like I say, we get between anywhere between 300 to 500 visitors to our site every single day.
Wow.
So if you have something that you want to share, either write it up in a Microsoft Word document or write it up in an email. I can copy and paste it. Just make sure that you send it to projectjfk@yahoo.com. And also in the subject line, put on there blog post, and I will go ahead and copy and paste that. And then it'll be in the blog entries. So when we have visitors, and I know we've had some visitors, you know, to the site, send me emails to let me know, hey, it's been a while since you updated any of your blog entries, and it has been. I mean, you know, work, kids, you know, the world is still turning, but, you know, since we
David was busy on January 6th, you know, in the Capitol.
Well,
yeah, he was carrying a gas mask.
Well, see, we have you guys, you know, arriving, you know, each month to these meetings, so I know that there is a treasure trove of your thoughts, what you guys are working on, what you want to post out there. I just got something from Dr. David Mantic yesterday or the day before that would be going on. I'm sure he sent that. I know he sent that to quite a few people. Yeah. I saw that in the email list. But, you know, things like that, Larry, obviously this information that you're working on, you know, go ahead and send me an email. And like I say, make sure in the subject line, just put on their blog post, please post this.
Okay.
And I'll get to it within 24 hours and get those posted up on the website. And it's a nice place to kind of have a message board, so to speak, that reaches a large audience.
Yeah, I mean, I want to be frank. I'm not optimistic that Carolyn Maloney is going to say, "Oh, great idea," you know. But we want to try to put pressure to get them at least to get on the committee level, not necessarily in the subcommittee level.
Sure.
The subcommittee could do something, and at the very least, build some media pressure.
All right.
I'd just like to interject, if you don't mind, regarding what Bill Simpich just mentioned regarding the documents that are left over. I just come out of a DPUK meeting, and Joe Bax was part of that, and he's one of the few people that really delves into this. And he basically said the following, is that about 170,000 RIF numbers are unaccounted for. So
really?
There are 350,000 in his collection, and only about 170,000 of them have been released as such. I scan personally Malcolm Blunt's archive, and I've been doing this for the last 2.5 years, and it's shocking that about, I'd say, and I wouldn't say precisely, but anything between 10% and 20% is not available online. And that is only because I've been checking the RIF numbers, feeding them into Google, looking at whether they're on the archive site or Mary Farrell or some other dodgy site. They're nowhere to be found. The best you can hope for is that they're mentioned in the Federal Register. And in most cases, all I get is a subtraction, because it's 3 numbers -5 numbers -5 numbers. So you're looking at -20,000 something. And so all you get in the end is a Google calculation as such. This is that's Malcolm's collection, basically, from what he collected from the mid 90s up till 2017, 2018 as such. From that collection, I can say 15 to 20% is basically unaccounted for online whatsoever, and they will be all released by the end of this year. But I think that the number is much, much higher of stuff that is nowhere to be found. 2 weeks ago, I just had a batch of riffs just like that, and none of them was accounted for, and it was all HSCA stuff.
Could you send your data on that to Rex Bradford over at Mary Farrell? That would be a big help, because he's worked very hard on combing through, and he'll be kind of stunned to hear what you're saying.
Okay.
And something also about the HSCA documents are being held, you know, suppressed until 2029, Martin Luther King and JFK, it seems, and testimony. So there are some, additional documents that may not be considered to be part of the core trove of archive documents. And, Sirhan is also up for parole. So there's RFK documents are also held that are, I think, outside of the traditional JFK, obviously outside of the JFK thing. So there's additional documents for those cases as well that are being held.
The documents that I've been scanning in are containing finder's aids to practically every law enforcement agency. Church Committee has got tons of missing stuff. Rockefeller Commission has got tons of missing stuff.
Those things were looted, as far as I'm concerned.
Malcolm basically not only dug into the CIA, but most deeply dug into what the archives as such have stored, and what the committees were actually asking for from the archives, from the CIA, and so forth. So basically, you're looking at a going to and back traffic of letters, basically, of the ARB or the HSCA, writing to the Central Intelligence Agency, of which Scott Breckinridge was one of the gatekeepers there. And you basically can start forming a picture of what is actually released, what needs to be redacted, and so forth. I found about a handful of documents, of which Malcolm has more complete versions of that are available online. But the majority of, you know, I had an email chain going on between me, Alan Dale, Malcolm, and Joe Bax, and I only sent them the documents with the riffs that I couldn't find a trace of online as such. And it was anything between 5 and 25 a day, basically. So, and that was week in, week out.
There was a National Declassification Board that was established as a follow-up to Obama's orders and a report that the PIDB, I forgot, Bill, what that stands for, Public Information Declassification Board or something like that. And there's a question as to jurisdiction, and I'm still researching this because they have a presumption after 25 years things should be released, and there's almost no basis for release or holding something after 50 years. And I'm trying to figure out, at least for the Martin Luther King and the Robert Kennedy, whether they would have jurisdiction over those records. The JFK Act, you might argue, has jurisdiction, although I'm not sure it's exclusive. But, there's been a lot of stuff that will happen under the – as I'm learning about this, this all relates to FOIA legislation. There was a FOIA Improvement Act in 2016. I got to dig down more on the precise – I don't think there's any precise boundaries, but there may be mechanisms to try to seek action. And I'm – what I'm trying to figure out, Bill Simpich, is whether there's a private right of action for the – to petition the National Declassification Board or not. I know there's none under the JFK Act, but I'm just...
That's a good question. I was going to say the same thing. I also wanted to add to Bart that we have a list on the AARC website of lost and destroyed.
I know.
You've looked
I know,
at
because the sometimes the RIFs, the RIF numbers are, besides on the Federal Register, they also get mentioned on the AARC website. And that's what Joe mostly did, put these things on the AARC website.
Oh, good.
So it does show up, but it's just the RIF number. There's nothing about the actual document itself, what it contains and what it's about, blah, blah, blah.
You can find out some of that information, some of the metadata, as they call it, if you go use the JFK Explorer tool. I could talk to you about it offline. It's a very powerful tool for looking for records.
Bart, did you find any of the Jim Galshenauer documents for the church committee?
Because Jim?
Jim Galshenauer, he's the guy that befriended Gayton Carver, who also knew of Moore, Agent Moore, Elmer Moore, who admitted that he had pressured
Can you spell Galshenauer, please?
G-O-C-H-E-N.
A-E-U-R, something like that. It's almost impossible to spell.
Yeah. Anyway, he says he testified before the church committee. Schweikert was in the room, and he says there's no evidence of his testimony in any of the records. And he had stuff to say about what Elmer Moore told him about pressuring, I'm drawing a blank. Who's the one that did the incision?
Several of the doctors, I'm sure.
What?
I think it was several of the doctors. I don't know if it was Perry.
Perry, yes, Malcolm
yeah.
Perry. So
yeah.
Moore pressured Perry. And then we had the doctor from Washington who spoke at the Kappa conference that actually spoke to Perry. They worked together. And Perry had admitted to him that he regretted succumbing to Moore's pressure. Anyway, so we have this like circle we've created, but Galshenauer said he actually testified at the church committee and there's no record. He's never been able to find evidence of his testimony. Maybe
he can join the queue with many others.
I'm just curious whether, because he calls me periodically, so we found anything, and I so far haven't.
No, nor have I.
So you're saying that we have 170,000 RFIs, RIFs, that are unaccounted for?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what Joe Bax told me, because he's got a list and he has 350,000 RIF numbers.
If Bill, how should we include that in the letter?
I think we should get Rex in on the loop first.
Okay.
Just because Rex could help us cross index it. He's got an index of every document at NARA. And Malcolm have documents that aren't in the NARA list.
Because I don't want to start saying things that make a point to me of saying you've exaggerated the problem.
No, you want to be careful. Just cross-ventilate it. That's all.
Okay. So, Rex,
I was going to say, I think Rex Bradford is the one who disseminated the information the last two or three years about how many documents were actually missing. But talking to you guys right now and Bart, it sounds like there's a heck of a lot more that are either missing or, and I have no idea where they're at. My God.
Well, let me tell you this.
Transcript somewhere.
I've scanned in 100,000 pages over the last 2.5 years. And that's not just, that's Malcolm's only. Before that, I did Harry Livingston's stuff. That was about 20,000.
Oh, really?
15,000 pages to 20,000 pages. I did 350 audio recordings, and I did about 300 video recordings. The videos are on the Meet the Lone Gunman YouTube site channel. The audio will be released in due course. The paper is partially released. The paper needs to be reorganized by me, which right now I don't have any interest in because I've been scanning for 6 months solid, 7 days a week. So,
right.
I'll, you can stop it as far as I'm concerned. So I've just taken 10 days off, and I know that in 2 weeks I'm going back to Malcolm. And of Malcolm, I've created so far 14,000 PDFs. The thing is that I didn't search for the RIF numbers because the thing was, the actual work to be done was meant to be only 6 months. And the reason was Malcolm's archive was going to be sent to the ARC, and he basically was going to, he had it at a different location, and that location was up for sale. And he says, when I've sold that and I've closed the deal, the stuff will go. And I said, fine. So he sent it off to a place where it's going to be put in a container, and it was going to be sent off to the States. That didn't happen. Then COVID happened. It still didn't happen. So in December, it was the first time I managed to get back into that, because what happened was that after we were finished in end of May of 2019, Malcolm has almost got the same amount, well, a bit less, in his own house. So so much paper. Yeah, we're talking 30 to 40 four-drawer file cabinets, basically. That's how much stuff he has. And the problem is also, you lot are hell-bent on organization. I know that John Newman is one of the most meticulous organizers. Well, just think about the opposite of that. Think about someone who basically has a bag. Let me just show you this.
One statement.
So basically, you've got a bag, right?
The bag, which is only a third filled, right? So you got a bag, then you've got a folder, like that. Not folders filled with paper.
And they're not related to each other.
I'm telling you, it's almost like you grab this bag and you drop it, right? And everything goes like that, and then you put it back together, and then you pretty much get an idea of what Malcolm's stuff. Malcolm's got it all in his head, but for an outsider, it's a total fucking nightmare to go through, because also, I'm knowledgeable about DPD, Oswald, the Prayer Man, this, that, and the other. But when you start talking about Bill Sturbitz, and you start talking about Scott Breckenridge and the traffic between him and G. Robert Blakey, which is immense, and all this stuff like that, and you go, what are you talking about? I have absolutely no idea what this is. So I basically try and get to know all this. So I basically have to find out how the entire structure of that archive is basically put together. And I'll tell you this, it took me 2 years to figure it out, because every time I was given different stuff, other stuff, because when it ended in May and the stuff was in the container, that was all the stuff from Dallas, Miami, and Harry Livingston, and a little bit of the agency. What he had at home was basically 80% agency and 20% FBI, Dallas, this, that, and the other. But the 20% that I did find for me was fucking gold, because there's no mention of any of this stuff anywhere whatsoever. It's just absolutely amazing.
To give everybody a sense of how important what Bart's doing is, Mary Farrell only has 10 to 15% of the stuff at the archives. That means that we're basically working with, you know, 1/10 of the deck.
And it's
really hard to come to any definite conclusions about anything when you're working with woefully incomplete information.
Yep.
And Bart, when you're when you said 100 online, are you making a distinction between the stuff that NARA releases that you can look at online and versus the boxes that have not been?
Like I said, I basically started checking the risks in June or July last year. So that's 9 months basically. 9 months I basically started putting not online on these risk sheets on the front. That's what I've been doing. That's from the last 9 months. But then again, I started relooking at stuff. I've got some ONI stuff, which will everyone will go, and basically none of that is online. There is no trace whatsoever. All you get is calculation. There's no trace of this stuff online. So overall, I'd say 20%, up to 20%. I don't know how much of it is not online of the stuff I did in the year after. When I basically started going through Malcolm's stuff that he had at his house, that was basically mostly spook stuff. He says, do you want to do this? And I said, yeah, it's all right. Now I've gotten to the point where I said, I'll do all of it because COVID has helped enabling me to do this as such. And I've just basically scanned everything in and slowly I don't have to send that many emails anymore with the documents attached to Malcolm and go, what the hell is this about? It's most of the time it'll be handwritten notes from the HSCA era. You know, sometimes you start recognizing the letter typing. I mean, Betsy Wolf has got one of the best handwriting that you can imagine. So, and I did a massive batch of folders on Betsy Wolf's drawing notes as such.
So, for example, when McKnight went through Rankin's files.
Rankin files. They're exempt from the JFK Act.
Right. But so there's no, he'll just reference a box number and a folder number. There's no RIF number. And is that because it's exempt from the JFK Act or because? And then RIFs, when you search for a RIF, if it's not scanned, it's like, say it's in a box, would you at least still see the RIF number just that it's not available?
The way it works is told by Malcolm. See, the thing is Malcolm went not just to NARA 1 and 2, but he also went to Tennessee and he went to Miami and he went to quite a few different places to get basically material from. He went at a time that there were no RIF sheets, first of all. That's one thing. So certain documents have absolutely no RIF sheet whatsoever. Then you got to look at it like Malcolm sometimes goes through a 6-page document of 4 pages of utter drivel and just thinks, you know what? I'm just taking these 2 pages because they've got the most important stuff in it. Although that didn't happen a lot. Then you've got to think about incomplete documents, of which there's also a fair bit, pages missing, 1 or 2. For instance, there's a really important page missing of the L.C. Dorman, the filmer, the HSCA document. There's page 4, I think, is missing of that. And he said to me, he says, I've been there 3 times and asked them as such. And the other thing, and the most important part, and this is the great thing, when you have the RIF number, the document exists, okay? So you can request this. And Malcolm told me, he says, you can request up to 100 pages of a document or documents for free from the National Archives. So what I did as well, all the risk sheets of all the documents that are not online, and so the document, I only have the risk sheet as a trace, for instance, you can go to the archives and attach that to your email and say, I want these particular documents. Can you send them to me as such? And if they say, we don't have them, then you've got a different problem. But at least you've got a trace of what it's about, you know, Paul Bodger or whoever else, yeah, you could basically search for that stuff because you have evidence of a trace of the particular RIF sheet as such to go after.
So the RIF sheet is only for quote-unquote assassination records, right? Was that Bill?
No, it's everything. Everything that's stored at the archives because the first 3 numbers refer to the organization, be it the Warren Commission, be it the FBI, and so forth.
Okay. So unless it's a particularly like Rankin's collection is exempt, but if you have Warren Commission records that are just sitting in a box, they haven't been scanned, they will have RIF numbers. They just won't be online.
I'm
correct.
What?
That's correct.
I don't want to quarrel about it. I've just noticed, Bart, a number of documents that are worn don't have RIP numbers. Yeah. But I had one other question while I got the floor. Have you ever seen a complete copy of the Dallas file, the Dallas FBI file? Because we have pieces of it on Mary Farrell, but we don't have the whole file. I don't know how we can assess the work in Dallas without having a complete copy of the file, which somebody in Dallas could probably do for us. They should have a copy of the file.
Yes, I don't think I've got everything, but because here's the thing. Malcolm started out in Dallas and worked in the municipal archives there with Cindy Smolovic, who he said has got very kind words about because she did whatever she could to assist him. And then after that, and that was basically when he started working together with John Armstrong. And then after that, he went, he hung out in Miami for a few years and worked a lot with Gordon Winslow. And then he went to also to the archives. And as far as I know, he lived about a mile away for about 6 months. He rented a flat about a mile away and spent 6 months there and basically copied whatever he could get his hands on as such. You'll be all in for a massive surprise when this stuff all comes out and gets released to you. Because here's the thing. You've all read books. You all know the ground matter, this, that, and the other, blah, blah, blah. But then you always think about the puzzle and the dark spots in it. Well, right. With that, you're going to be able to put these bits in there as such. I'm not saying, oh, it's going to be solved, this, that, and the other. But you will find things. Because my papers, I've stopped writing my papers. And I've very little for the last 12 months, 18 months, because every time I find more stuff. So I said, you know what, I'm going to put this whole thing on hold till I've gone through all the old stuff, which I hope to do in March, and then basically take everything with me that is left to do as such. And you will never hear me say that the CIA did it as such. From reading what I've seen, I'd say go to the Pentagon, the JCS, and the NSC, basically, those people, because they give the order to the CIA. When you look at the documents, they say how many guns go to Cuba, how many grenades, how many this, how many that. I mean, the CIA implements it. They've got their little show on the go with all their little groups and so forth. But the real orders, they come from upstairs.
So it's interesting how JCS backed away from the Bay of Pigs at the last minute.
I've got tons of stuff on the NSC with George Bundy, tons of memos, tons of NSC stuff. You know, all that Pentagon stuff is really interesting reading, and it's really simple. They give the game away by basically, you know, there's one document that I found that's like, there was just a shopping list of weaponry that will be needed for whatever operation they're doing down there in Cuba. And it just shows. And it's just like, what? And going on, who's giving the orders then? They are. They say where the weapons and what's all going and what's going to be used as such. So that to me was just a giveaway. But it's the beauty of Malcolm's archive is that you've got a set of folders and then you've got a load of subfolders in there. And you will see, you can basically find out about all the traffic in between the committee and the so-called agencies as such. And then you've got all the interviews, be it partial or complete. And then, you know, just slowly you start to see how this whole thing is basically interconnecting. And it took me 2 years to make sense of it, basically. You know, it was all in Malcolm's head. But, you know, there's, like I said, the whole thing from a paper point of view and trying to organize it was an absolute mess. And, you know, slowly but surely I managed to get a grip on it, so to speak, and understand what it's all about and how that whole thing works. And for me, my whole Dallas thing, I didn't never knew that Wolf Fritz talked to the HSCA. It wasn't very valuable, but it did have some meaning to me, and especially with all the other police officers, because it's amazing how many, they did about 30 or 40 officers that they spoke to for the HSCA. So it's all brilliant for me. I didn't find that much on the Texas School Book Depository. But I did find a whopper of a document from Hostie that I shared already 2 years ago, which I found in Malcolm's archive. I don't know if you know about this, but basically this is a document that Hostie wrote while just after the first interrogation of Oswald. And Hostie mentions this in his book, actually. He takes a block of blank affidavit papers and goes into the other room inside room 317 and starts basically taking notes of the possessions of Oswald that had been taken in at that time. So at that time, that's 4 o'clock, 2 hours after his arrest. Hostie came at 2:45, and basically he writes it all down. But then he also starts writing a preliminary report, and he basically states that Oswald was outside on the landing and that he went for a Coke before he came out. And Oswald went outside to watch the presidential parade as such, which is about the best piece of evidence to support Prayer Man being standing there, besides Will Fritz's handwritten notes. But on top of that, I started looking at that document and compared it with Hostie's notes that were discussed with by Helmer Reinberg on the Lancer website about 20-odd years ago, and which Hostie denied having, but when his book came out, all of a sudden, by miracle, started to appear as such. But that particular document was among 200 pages of just Hostie material that was there. You all know that Hostie was hanging out with Ed Coyle just before the shooting started of the 112th. But what a lot of people don't know is that that's the day before Hostie had a rook with Revel the day before the assassination. So that's why Revel shafted him with Ganaway with that report that he said, like, oh, he's a card-carrying communist who was ready to kill, and Oswald was ready to kill the president and so forth, which got that whole thing with Hostie into dark waters. And he basically got a shafting from Hoover and all the others, and he disappeared after the first interrogation. The first interrogation of Oswald, I'll tell you what, it's really simple. His alibi was destroyed in that very first interrogation, and Oswald had no clue what was going on. When he spoke to Forrest Sorrells at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, when the first interrogation ended, Oswald was still none of the wiser. He thought that Forrest Sorrells was a lawyer. And then when Forrest Sorrells says, no, I'm a Secret Service agent, he goes, like, well, aren't you here to provide me one? He says, like, no. So he spoke for him about 10 minutes, and then he was off to the so-called lineup to get in front of Helen Markham as such. That's another joke, because Oswald was frisked when in the car, but he was also frisked before he was left to Gus Rose and Richard Stovall at that time. I forgot his name. It was a uniform cut. He said that during the HSCA. He said, I frisked him real good. Next thing, he's being interrogated by Fritz and Bookout and Hostie. Then he goes to the lineup for Markham, and then Boyd and that other forgetful bastard. Sims. What's his name?
Was it Sims?
Yeah. Richard Sims. What a joke. So basically, Sims and Boyd frisk him before that, and all of a sudden, by miracle, find the bullets to the gun.
Yeah.
They find it, and the bus ticket. That's when they find that. So the second I get that HSCA report about the other copper, Charles Truman Walker, that's his name, he basically goes through that, and it's like, hold on a minute. How can somebody frisk you real good and not see? I mean, the ticket might be. Bus ticket is possible. But half a dozen bullets in your pocket? No way. I don't believe that. So,
anyway. It was the second frisking when they found the bullets.
Yep. That's
the third frisking that you're talking about, in theory. Okay? Because the second frisking is Charles Truman Walker.
First is in the car. Yeah.
Yeah. Is in the car.
Did you see any information in the Hostie file about the supposed the bad guys that Oswald supposedly met with right before the assassination?
No.
No? No reference to it?
No. But I tell you, give you another hammer. It's really simple. I found that out because I just started looking into it. There's a problem with the Heidel ID, okay? The Heidel ID is not mentioned at all on the 22nd by anybody. No one. There's not one piece of record that says, here you go, we found the Heidel ID. Afterwards, from the 23rd onwards, sure, there's a mention of it. The problem is this. Manning Clements says that he sees Oswald at 10 o'clock, which
right.
is wrong, because MG Hall, which is the guy with the glasses with the white hat on who's escorting him with Boyd, Oswald, with Boyd all the time. He's really precise in his report. Every minute, every hour, anything is clocked perfectly. He disagrees with the whole thing and says, no, he was there around just before 7 o'clock, 20 to 7, if I'm not mistaken. This is around the time that Oswald says that he's a patsy. So, Clemens says in his report from the 23rd that while Oswald's taken out for a lineup, which is the Davis sisters lineup at that time, he gets up, goes outside, and starts looking at the evidence that's been collected. Now, in this report from the 23rd, he don't make a mention of any other item of evidence that he sees besides the Heidel ID. Okay. When does Will Fritz, James Buchow, who was there when Clemens arrived, and Thomas Kelly, when do you think they make mention of this? On the 23rd, on the first interrogation, at the very end of that interrogation, and there's three reports that confirm this. It's the handwritten notes of Fritz, Buchow's report, and Thomas Kelly report. And it's all at the end of that report that they make mention of it. So think about it. Oswald gets arrested at 2 o'clock. His stuff's all being brought out and laid out. Da-di-da-di-da. And there's no fucker that makes any mention of it whatsoever until the next day at 11:30.
Is that when they ask him and he says, well, you're the cop, you figure it out.
You know what? I don't even think that's true. You know, because all that stuff, yeah, okay, there's a lot of stuff that's just made up by these coppers. Mm-hmm. Here's the thing, right? If I had to dense it all down and put it into a documentary and then in a snippet for 30 seconds and so forth, then I'll come up with stuff like that. Jim Lovell has been proven to be one of the biggest liars in this whole thing whatsoever.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because in the last 20 years, all he did was claim that he interviewed Oswald. Well, you could just grab the Warren report and you grab the report that he basically wrote about his duties and what he all did. You weren't anywhere close to Oswald on the 22nd whatsoever. Nowhere. Never spoke any time. Not until the morning of the 24th. He was too busy with the lineups, putting them together and basically guarding all that and making sure that happened all right. And give Markham smelling salts and so forth. That was Lavelle's duty. He was nowhere, anywhere close during any of the first five or six interrogations as such, only on Sunday morning. Same as Harry Dean Holmes, who just comes walking in, parading in. Oh, I was on my way to the church, but I thought, I'll just go past Fritz's office. And lo and behold, Fritz says, why don't you just come in and enjoy me in this interrogation? That's how it went. I've basically been now studying this interrogation after the second floor lunchroom, Fugazi. I've been studying this since end of 2017 now, it was 300 and odd pages long, and now it's going to be 350 or 60 odd pages, and that's all extra stuff that I found from Malcolm's archive. So that will be released just before November, the assassination weekend. So
you're saying that Oswald, the hostie said Oswald said he was outside. Obviously, the motorcade is delayed.
He's just watching the presidential parade. That's what it says.
But they were delayed, so then he went upstairs to get a Coke?
No. He got the Coke before he went out. This is another thing. If you read the interrogation reports, the joint hostie and Buchow report is done on the 22nd. And that's the only type of evidence that hostie is involved together with Buchow doing this interrogation. When Oswald's dead, Hostie rewrites that report and changes three key things in that report and basically makes it sound that Oswald got the coke after the shooting, whereas the first report clearly states he got a coke for his lunch. Okay? I did about 180 pages on that as well. Amazing, for a minute and a half supposed to be, and I got 180 pages where I just basically plastered all the evidence in there, right?
It
just basically shows that what a massive fugazi the second floor lunchroom encounter is. It's the biggest lie ever.
You have that online?
Oswald gave him the idea. That's the problem.
Yeah,
and they switched it around. That's what they did. And then they changed the report. And the report from Hostie himself, the handwritten notes as well, says, got a Coke for his lunch. Then had his lunch, then went outside to watch the presidential parade. And I've got Marina Oswald as well, IDing him and say it's Lee as well. We showed her the pictures and she went, it's Lee. We got her on tape for that. And she said, yeah, it's fine. use it if you want to. And then, you know, the interrogations as well, everything else. If you look at the Hidelka, if I can't find any evidence of the 22nd that says we've got the Hidel ID, this, that, and the other, then it would have been brought up right there and then and said, what are you doing with two IDs in your pocket?
Right.
It doesn't
right.
get brought up till the next day, 11:30. So you got to ask yourself, if I cut that head of the snake off, right, then everything else is bollocks. The rifle, the whole enchilada, everything is like, hold on a minute, you cut the head of the snake because no one on the 22nd has a word, not a single word about that particular ID as such.
Do you have
this, sound like I'm ranting, but
do you have this written up on the website?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, if you go to the Prayer Man site, I scroll down a little bit. There are my papers, the old versions. The new versions aren't on there yet. But the thing is, like, I've got a long version and I've got a bullet point version. And the bullet point version points to the pages as such. What I did is that I refer to the evidence by including the evidence. So when I say such and such is happening, then you get four pages of documents that you can trawl through and basically go, right, okay. So you don't have to click on a lot of links. It's all in there basically, because that's what I've done at Basio. I put it together with the second floor lunchroom Fugazi. I basically put it in pieces together, like Baker's Drive, Baker's Run, the stairs, the vestibule inside, going up the stairs, the actual lunchroom encounter, and what happens afterwards, then the reenactments and so forth. And with I tried to do that with the interrogations, and it didn't work out, so I had to change it. And then I thought, you know what? And I saw two videos, and I knew around what time they were taken. That was another thing. The videos I went through, I was like, I'm trying to basically time them as like when did this all happen? Was he on his way to a lineup? Was he coming back from jail? And so forth. That was really hard to figure out. And I then thought, basically, chop all the documentation up and put it exactly in the sections of this is the interrogation at that time. He's walking to this. Then he's got this lineup and so forth. And then I just basically collected everything I had and chucked it in there. And so you have a timeline, but it's 350 odd pages long. It's not bad for 48 hours.
Hey, Barb, this case equivalent, I wanted to point out to you that your research is what I'm going through right now with Prayer Man and also the interrogation. Brian Edwards and I were arguing, probably about 25 years ago over Baker's statement. And I sat there and I said, okay, which statement are we going to accept? Statement number one, statement number two, statement number three, statement number four. I go, good God. And I think it's over maybe a 2-day period that he has these statements. And I think the Warren Commission accepted the last one. And then when I get through your site, I'm sitting there going, wow, maybe Baker saw him, I think like you're insinuating, as he walked up the steps or ran up the steps to find an elevator with Truly behind him. And he maybe saw Oswald with a can of Coke or a bottle of Coke there.
Let me pop that bubble yeah. for you.
Okay, good.
Okay. First of all, Baker does not run up the stairs right away. If you study the film, the Darnell film, you see that Baker crosses past the stairs. He doesn't make the direction towards it. Now, it's very hard to go a 3D situation going into a 2D situation. There's a massive...
He goes back to the elevator first, right?
No, if you look at the movie, you can see, if you follow the imaginary line of Baker, you see that he's not going towards the steps.
Right.
All the other people that are going into a straight line to the steps as such, basically returning to the Texas School Book Depository, walk in a total different direction. Also, if you check out his Warren Commission testimony, he has to be led by, I think it is Joseph Ball or Bellin, I don't know exactly, but he has to be led by him by basically saying that he went up those stairs directly. My interpretation is that he went past the stairs and looked up to the Deltex and to the fire escape on the side of the Texas School Book Depository because he knew those shots from high up, but he didn't know where they were coming from exactly. And that's why he went over there. The other thing is that there's supporting evidence for the fact that Truly may have gone up the stairs by himself as such. Joe Molina stood on the steps, and he said only Truly went in. Buell Frazier did not see a helmeted officer going in either. So that's two or three even, the people that said no one went up. Oh, we have Roy Edward Lewis as well, who stood at the door opening at that time, right behind Frazier. And he said as well, there's no one coming in at that point. No one. They stood there and they left. Shelley and Lovelady leave the steps almost immediately after the last shot is fired.
And they run to the ground.
The Couch film. This is also in the Donnell film. When you read, they talk so much bullshit, it's not even funny anymore, when you talk the Warren Commission testimony. In the Warren Commission testimony, they say they stood there for 3 minutes before they left. The Couch film proves that they're full of it. Their first statement for FBI and for Lovelady and for the DPD first statement of Shelley says they left right away. Buell Frazier said words to that effect as well. They both left as well right away. Now, the problem is that when you go to the Warren Commission testimony of Shelley, it said that they looked back. Well, in the Couch film, there's no trace of them looking back whatsoever. But he says, we saw them standing outside in front of the stairs. Now, how long was that? That wasn't just immediately and flying, zooming up those stairs together where they had to push people out of the way. Here's the problem with Roy Truly. It's the biggest problem of Roy Truly is that he keeps egging it on. He keeps thickening the story more and more and more because and every time he does that, he gets himself into trouble and ends his sentence with, oh, I don't know. So first he goes with a lot of detail that has absolutely makes no sense whatsoever. And then he goes, nah, I don't know whatsoever. They didn't storm those steps as quickly as they claimed to be. When the HSCA, I posted this about 2 weeks ago, did a test. The HSCA went to Dallas and they asked the guy who was looking after the building at that time. The building was empty and they did a test of going from the sniper's nest to the second floor lunchroom. And they did it in 45 seconds. That's half the time that what the Secret Service apparently came up with. Now, okay, there's no boxes. There's no rifle to clean, blah, blah, blah. But still, they do it in half the time. Do you know what made me actually investigate this thing? And that was a really simple thing back 8 years, 9 years ago. When Roy Truly said he walked up the stairs in front of Baker. Now, what nutcase walks up when there's an assassin with a rifle or whatever weapon on him going down the steps trying to escape the building? And yeah, you're taking a police officer with a gun pulled up the stairs and you're in the middle of it? Oh, you want to be in the middle of a potential crossfire? That makes absolutely no sense whatsoever as such. And you know what? But you know what the hammer is? I started reading about Truly, and Truly three times said that the officer was ahead of him, not behind him. He said it in three newspaper interviews as such. He basically screwed up royally. Then the Secret Service gets involved in the first week of December, and they twist everything around for a lot of people and add a lot of info to it as such as well. The Secret Service made an absolute mess of these people's statements.
And then Earl Warren allowed the lawyers, over the objections of some of the lawyers, when they first went to Dallas, they were allowed to do unrecorded interviews with the witnesses before they actually were deposed or testified on the record.
Yeah, let me give you a hint.
There's no record, you know, who knows how their testimony was shaped during those interviews. There's no record of those interviews.
Malcolm has a document that shows that the interviews of all the people that what the Warren Commission had done in Dallas, that those interviews were shipped in 67 to the archives.
Really? Now, these are the pre-interviews?
No one had their hands on those interviews, basically. So this typed out, bang, there you go. Now, the beauty of it is it comes with an accession number. An accession number is, according to Malcolm, is a gold ticket at NARA. It basically means you walk in with that number, you go, boss, here you go. I want to go and look at these files. Then all they have to do is take that, walk upstairs, and they don't even have to look because I've never been to NARA yet, but they basically say, It's one of the most frustrating experiences to deal with because of their whole search and cataloging and so forth. But that ticket, that so-called assessment number, you basically have a gold ticket because it shows you where that particular, those files are. And this is about three or four cabinets basically filled with that paper on these interviews as such. And guess where it is?
In the window.
Every time Malcolm went to the archives, there's no trace of any of those files whatsoever. Because, I'll tell you what, if those files would come out and if open, yeah, it will probably show you how much has been edited out and been censored and so forth. So no, yeah, no kidding. So they just make that disappear as such.
Bart, did Fritz copy Bookhouse notes and then he put them in as his notes?
Sean Murphy brought that up back in 2013. It is because of the sequencing of things written down as such. It is quite possible because also Fritz wasn't known as a note taker.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, and this is the same with Harry Dean Holmes, these guys were so old school that if they did an interrogation, they would talk to suspects and they'd have a detective join them in that particular conversation. Nothing was written down. And then when it came to court, say Fritz or Decker, they would talk and they'd say this and that. And then they would get in the other detective to confirm it as such.
Yeah.
And that was enough. In those days, you know, there was no recording going on, not at least for another 20 odd years. I think mid 80s police stations started to record interviews as such.
Yeah, Fritz was known for his interview techniques of getting confessions.
Okay. Yeah, he did that really well that weekend. It went really well.
I was going to ask you, if you said that, you know, they were old school. If you look at his testimony, I'm talking about Harry Holmes. You look at his testimony, the commission, it's almost like it was recorded and he wrote it down verbatim. I'm just curious of what your thoughts are on that. Have you read his testimony?
The beauty of Holmes' testimony is that he wasn't part of the club. The DPD
right.
Robbery and Homicide Club, and therefore gave too much away. And basically, Holmes actually contradicts the second floor lunchroom Fugazi story as it's been brought forward by the other DPD, Fritz especially. So that's one thing, that's a good thing. He also pretty much points out where it happened. And that was in the vestibule where the altercation happened. Now, whether that was with Baker is a good question. There was I forgot the officer's name. Greg Parker brought it up. I forgot his name.
Smith?
Sorry?
Is it Smith?
No. It's, well, maybe it'll come to me. But it's a German name, German-sounding name. And... it could be Baker, but it could be the other guy. And basically, Holmes gave the game away with regarding that whole scenario that they tried to play out. The vestibule as well. If you look up what a vestibule means, it is not that little tiny area that's in between the landing of the second floor and the actual lunchroom. People think that basically that bit was built to keep the noise out from the offices and the lunchroom because those stairs were really noisy because they're just wooden stairs and people with their heels, especially women, would just make a lot of racket as such coming down.
You know, Bart, I'll tell you, when I speak to students about this, I have to give definitions of a vestibule and also an alcove. And I'm assuming that the steps leading up to the Texas School Book Depository is an alcove, and the vestibule is right behind there, if that's what you're talking about.
Yeah. Right. Well, behind the glass doors.
Yes.
Starting at the glass doors where there was a cigarette machine and the staff elevator that went up to the fourth floor and the steps that go to the second floor up to the double set of doors that basically leads towards the expedition area where Truly had his office and Shelley had his office and so forth.
Okay.
A lot of people also don't understand that when you come up on top of the stairs, you're on the first floor. A lot of people think that's the ground floor, but it isn't.
Yeah.
It's the first floor. Because the ground level, where you are on the pavement, that's ground floor. That's zero. So going up the steps, you're right away on the first floor as such. So, but, you know, and so hopefully by the end, and then I've got a paper coming out on Prayer Man, and I've got a paper out coming out on the Texas School Book Depository about the people. There's one really important factor that a lot of people have overlooked, and it's really, it's a pity that Barry Ernest didn't go deeper into this, because it's actually Barry Ernest's book that got me to focus on the Texas School Book Depository and the happenings inside, is that the fourth floor, the three black guys from the fifth floor went downstairs and talked to the women of the fourth floor while they were looking outside the window, and they were all near the wooden steps when Baker came up and with Truly, and so that whole element, because they were chatting there. And that whole thing, if you look at the interviews of the Warren Commission and the statements made by the three black guys, they're trying to basically sweep it under the carpet as well. That's another thing. And that also gives, you know, they did their best to basically to discredit Victoria Adams and Sandra Stiles. Sandra Stiles wasn't even called in. There are eight women, at least eight women, on the fourth floor when it happens. It's not just Stiles and Adams and Elsie Dorman and the supervisor. I forgot her name. So there's four more women, and I tell you there's 10, because two people, of which one says, I was on the fourth floor. And the next statement, she's basically changed it to saying, I stood on the steps. And there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever of her standing on those steps. So I called her daughter, and her daughter said to me, the FBI made her do it. She had an uncle in the FBI, and the AI had a chat and says, you need to change your testimony from the fourth floor going down to the steps leading up to the first floor as such.
And you,
I was like, no, I don't believe it. And I was like, no, she did. They made her change that.
Did you put that in your paper?
Yeah, that's in the paper, yeah. That's in the paper.
You know, the three black men were all asked by either Alan Dulles or Jerry Ford if they've ever been in trouble with the law before. And that question was asked also of Eunice and Gibbons. The black witnesses were asked that question, white witnesses or not.
Gibbons was caught with 2 ounces of weed before that. Eddie Piper had a DUI 10 years before, but 1963 Dallas. That's like a life sentence for a couple of
things. Only the black witnesses were asked that question. And there was a reason for that. That was to intimidate them.
We've progressed since then, haven't we, up to 2021? Wow. I don't mean to be flippant, but I'll tell you what. You know, Black Lives Movement and everything, I'm sitting there going, God, this is crazy stuff. I know basically that I want to point out a couple of things, you know, before
Phil, okay?
Thing out, is that
yeah, good to see you. I've still got the
go ahead.
Go ahead, Casey.
Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say thank you guys all very much for the research that you guys are doing, and also the
let me just put the conference on silent if I can.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, you know, there's a possibility. Could you speak at the conference that we have in April and May?
April and May. Yeah. Make it May.
Yes. My arm. Yeah, I'll do it.
you know what the problem is that I've got so much evidence, and trying to condense it is more of a mission than gathering the evidence, because you want to be able, you know, I'd want to refer people to the paper and say like, well, you know what, just go there, because if I talk, I can do an 8-hour speech easily without.
You did great just extemporaneously today. So that's all you got.
Absolutely.
So the thing is that by that time, I also probably know what Malcolm, what's left to do of Malcolm's material. And, you know, then I know, are there any pieces of the puzzle that I found out and basically be able to stick in as such.
I do have one question, and I hope you can answer, because I was doing some stuff with Malcolm's book, and Alan Dale, and he brought up a 201 file. All right, so I know basically what a 201 file is, but then he insinuated that, well, there's a 301 file too. Can you tell me what a 301 file is?
Basically, I've come across 301 a little bit, but basically it was a system that ran parallel to 201, but that's all destroyed. And okay. I think in one of the interviews on video on YouTube of Alan's interviews with Malcolm, and I think it's a Lancer, or it's that the Torch, yada, yada, 2014 that they did then. That will probably explain about more in depth about that. Like I said, I had to learn how the entire archive from Malcolm is functioning, and I'm still not 100% sure. I know that he's got left. I know that he's got about a pile this, like, I don't know, 3 feet tall just on Bessiana and 3 feet tall on Nosenko. I already scanned in tons on Nosenko. That is a book by itself. And I think Malcolm is going to do something. Write an article or write a book or something of some sort.
Bart, let's
okay. The 301s are for proprietaries, the companies that were working with the CIA. That's the difference between the 201, which
is
individuals.
That's it. The companies that were affiliated with it. Yeah.
Is that inclusive of the buildings itself too?
It's companies, which will include the buildings.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he mentioned something like, well, that the 301 files, which could be the Texas School Book Depository building. And I said, okay, companies versus buildings or both? I assume both.
This whole TSBD, CIA connection, et cetera, is built on a cloud, okay? That's as much grip you're going to get on it. There's absolutely nothing to really support that. The Glaze letters are an absolute joke. I don't believe a word of it whatsoever. And that's just conspiracy rubbish, basically, and making it sound more... You know what? Roy Truly was a racist. The second he found out that Oswald, who was a good worker, who was an excellent worker, because he said, I wish I had 5 workers of him. That's how proud he was, because he just did his job and got it done. That's what Oswald did. But the second he found out that he was a commie agitator and he defected to Russia, that's like in Dallas, Texas in 1963, that's like, give him the knife, because there's 10,000 other people who want to slit your throat right now for the fact that you're a commie bastard. This is 1960s Dallas, basically, and just, like being a communist. And even now, I mean, even in 2021, they still use that term to basically put you down as such. Oh, he's a communist. I mean, it's got no meaning whatsoever now, but back then, it weighed a lot heavier as such.
Hey, Bart, the Livingston materials, does that include raw interviews? Notes?
Yeah. Transcripts. You know what? Hey, Livingston was about the most obsessive note taker I have ever seen in my entire life. Absolutely crazy.
Have you put those online?
Some of it is online. You go to the Dealey Plaza UK website, DealeyPlazaUK.com, and go to research and then the subtext collections.
Because he's, we have dead witnesses that he interviewed extensively, so...
Well, the tapes are going to be released at some point, and it's there's a lot of tapes of that. This is another thing. He called everyone, and I mean everyone, but he was clever. He had this guy called Wavright, Richard Wavright, and Wavright was a cop, and he went into the police computer because there was no internet at that point. It was in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. So he had him to go into the police computer and find these people and basically get their phone numbers. And then you can just hear him breathe, because he's got an audio cassette tape running at the same time. And you just hear him breathing in between. And he starts dialing the phone, and he just gets him on the phone. And he's really clever. Every time he does it, he says, I'm a researcher, blah, blah, blah. I got a best-selling book and blah, blah, blah. And can you give me 5 minutes of your time? Before you know it, he's talking 30 to 45 minutes with these people, and he talks everything. And he managed to get hold of pretty much everyone that is related to the autopsy, because, of course, that was his number one thing.
Right. Because, I mean, you know, when a person writes a book, they're placing stuff in the book that they think is important. But as a lawyer, I'd like to see the whole interview to see maybe there were tidbits in there that the writer may not have appreciated or significant from a legal standpoint.
Some of the bits were – the thing is also Malcolm got it in 1999, if I'm not mistaken. And the collection comprises of late 80s to about 94, 95. That's it. We know that Livingston lived on for almost another 20 years.
Yeah.
And I know that he had an apartment that was absolutely filled to the brim with boxes of all kinds of stuff. And he then went into a home. And what happened with that stuff, I wouldn't be surprised if it went into the container. Boom, just like that.
Did he have any significant other at that point?
We don't know. Because also he was more concentrating on writing fiction books. He wrote all kinds of fiction books after that. You know, when he wrote Killing the Truth, he basically shot himself in the feet several times over with that, and made him public enemy number one in among the research community as well. Although at the same time, I've seen some real nasty shit done by other people towards him as well. One example was that Robert Groden tried to nail him in front of the court for child molestation and such, whereas the only thing that he had done was basically kiss his son on top of his head, and that was the only thing, and Groden went all the way. When it came to it, Groden held on to it. When it came to it, Groden left and let it go. As such, Groden made a mint. I've seen the check stubs, I've seen the invoices, I've seen everything. I didn't scan that in because I just don't want to, for other people to relive all this crap. And this Zapruder, he had at least 5 feet of material on just Zapruder. And I said to Malcolm, you can fuck off, I'm not scanning all that in. There's no way in hell I'm scanning all this in. It's too much work. You know, I've got a pretty fast system lined up as such. I shoot it all with my iPhone. I don't scan them in with a flatbed scanner.
Right.
I've done it all with my iPhone. So that is much quicker. You do it 10 times quicker. So
yeah.
I do anything between, I said I do a minimum of 25 PDFs a day, but I did sometimes up to 100 and a minimum of 300 pages. And sometimes I've done 10, about 1,000, 1,100. A lot of 400 or 500s, loads of them. So it just depends, because sometimes you get Malcolm stuff and you don't know what it is, and you're just looking at batches of one or two pages, and there's a whole bag filled with that. So then you're looking at, my God, I've got hundreds of PDFs in just one bag. So
you have a stand for your camera, so you don't have any fuzzy, any blurriness?
No. These apps are pretty, pretty good. One of them is by Adobe, and the other one was called iScan, which iScan I used for 2 years. Then I got fed up with it, because sometimes the app crashes, and especially when you do 100 or 120 pages,
yeah.
Which at that point you want to throw your phone against the wall, and lots of cussing and profanity, and you're going, it's like, I've got to do that whole caboodle again. So that got so frustrating at that point that I changed apps, and the Adobe one isn't much better as well. You need to not let the screen go dark and stuff like that, because once it's in the middle of an operation of saving it or sending it or whatsoever, the screen goes dark, it shuts it down. So that you live and you learn, basically, with this stuff. But,
you know, we had a very famous car dealership in New York called Fugazi. So you got to be careful when you start using that term.
Hey, but,
yeah.
I just want to throw something out there to you. Have you looked into the Epson ES 400 or 500 document scanner?
No.
Well, if you get a chance, look it up. I'm sure they sell them over in the UK. That's what me and Brian Edwards have. And we scan – we went down to Gary's house and J. Gary Shaw's house, and also we're working on the Dick Russell collection right now.
Oh, wow.
And I tell you what, I mean, we can scan on average of around, I would say 15 to 20,000 pages a day per scanner. So it
makes how expensive is that scanner?
About $300.
Which one is it?
It's the Epson ES400, and if you want the Wi-Fi version, I wouldn't suggest doing the Wi-Fi version. I know that's the one Brian has now, and it's a great scanner, but you want to plug it directly into the USB cable on your computer.
Yeah.
But
so the Echo Sierra 400. That's Echo Sierra 400. Okay.
Yeah, Epson ES400 or the Epson ES500. But both of them are the exact same. They scan in color and black and white. I know that, you know, a lot of the collections that we're working on and what I've been doing the last, you know, year and a half, 2 years, it makes a whole lot less work. Than I was doing things by the cell phone, too, when I'd go down to the Dallas Public Library. And the reason why is because at the library, you're not allowed to put any pressure on a document. You can take a photograph with your phone, great, but if you have the actual documents there and you can load, you know, 50 pages in at a shot, hit the button, and 50 pages will go through in less than a minute. And that's front and back. So it makes a lot, and not only that, but as you scan it, you can save it as a JPEG or as a PDF. And if you want to say you have an entire folder that's one section, you want to make that one PDF, you can feed it until that folder is done, and then you've got your one PDF file that is front and back of your documents. So,
you see, Neil, this is the difference between Britain and the United States. You know, United States just goes fucking pro right there and then and go, what? Let's get a tank. We don't need a small car. No, we're going to get a tank and we're going to get moved forward. This is the difference.
But here's the difference.
I think you better use some of those excess fees, Bart, to buy you a new scanner, don't you?
No, that'd be good.
All the tens of thousands that we have in the account, yeah?
I'll give this to the UK. You're the ones that gave us Doctor Who, so hey, I'm a big fan there. I got to see it. If I ever get a chance to cross the pond, I want to see from that shit. So
I hope that my main plan is just when I go into March, because we're still in lockdown, and I think they're going to let people back to school on the 8th of March, and then gradually open the country up, because vaccinating, I think Britain is ahead of everyone when it comes to vaccinations. I think they're doing about 500,000 people a day.
Wow.
And it's really rapid. And also, they started 3 months early than Europe, and there's been a big tiff about that, because the English were just a little bit quicker than the rest of Europe, because they were dithering about, of course, and then the Europeans got pissed off. And,
one of the benefits of Brexit, huh?
Well, but the only thing that's a benefit of Brexit.
The only fucking benefit of Brexit,
absolute,
definitely.
Absolute nightmare. Yeah,
fucking
you can't
nightmare.
Send it. It's everything you order outside or send over that goes across the border to the continent, they'll put VAT on top of it right away. So it's 20%.
So your wine prices have gone up, huh?
Everything. Food as well. Everything's gone up. So, and do you know what they said to the businesses that export to Europe? Set up shop in Europe. That's what they said. So basically, a lot of companies are now chopping off part of their employees that worked in the UK and basically get different employees in France or in the Netherlands, and set up a sister company as such, and so they can export or send all the stuff out without having to pay VAT. Because, of course, their clients, no client is willing to pay that. And it's the same when you order stuff in. All that drops to practically zero because it's just too expensive to buy. And then, of course, you've got the paperwork. The paperwork is huge. They've got to fill in so much paperwork now compared to what they had to do last year. So that's just an absolute nightmare, the whole thing. Yeah.
Hey,
terrible.
Bart, I'm going to show you real quick here. Let me screen share this. This is what the Epson ES400 looks like. It's not much bigger than a little printer.
Wow.
But, you know, you can load your sheets in, and then it scans them through. So, like I say, I don't use that part of it. But, you know, it's what they call a duplex document scanner, so it scans front and back at the same time. And then, you can get right now for $249.99 right from the website.
Everything is so dirt cheap in the States. It's just sick.
So, yeah, I just want to throw that out there because when you said you were using
it. Oh, yeah. You're doing me a massive favor, especially that price. Rub it in, mate.
Yeah. Well,
so it's three, four times more the price. Don't you think, Nelly? It's like, oh, you buy something for $250 or £600 in
England. That's where you get somebody to buy it in the States and then ship it, FedEx.
You're on 110 volts. We're on 230.
Oh. that's
true.
Make it complicated. Why don't you? So.
Well, the nice thing about it is, I think Epson, you can choose, depending on what voltages you need to use, they'll put a different plug on it. They'll have the U.S. version and they'll have like an overseas version. So I know Epson's pretty decent about that.
Well, I'm gonna Google this after the meeting. So over the year, I hope to have it finished by November. The archive, the Livingston archive, is partly online. What isn't online is the medical stuff because. I'll give you this so you can gossip around. I've got a document which is 30 pages, which is from Jackie Hess, which is a report of Jackie Hess going to, I think it's NPC, the photo lab, Kodak, whatever, something like that. And she goes with the prints of the autopsy. And there's almost 100 prints and x-rays of that particular autopsy. And Jackie Hess is almost about the most meticulous person I've ever come across because there's 5 pages describing every shot of those rolls of film of Kennedy's autopsy. And these are 335mm films on top of that x-rays. But on top of that, she describes about the rest of the 28 pages. She describes how she took the prints, when she went to the lab, who she met at the front door, who she met as the people in the lab, name, this, that, and the other. Every bloody step she took inside that place is written about. And then, like, in only 2 occasions didn't she have an opportunity or a chance to be with the photographs and the material as such, because prints being inside the printer and in the chemicals and so forth and coming out the dryer. I'm thinking of writing a piece after I've done this Prema Malaki to do a piece on the autopsy photos, because not only Harry Livingston was big friends with Mark Crouch and they talked a lot on the phone. And also there's lots of folders full of documentation about the particular Secret Service set. That's the set that everybody knows, the 6 pictures. But then Malcolm went into the archives. And when Malcolm went, he just went, Malcolm is zero interest in any of it. So he just went, oh, someone may want to use that kind of mentality. And basically just got all these documents about Secret Service saying there's pictures coming out soon. Because such and such got hold of it, this, that, and the other. So the whole story behind the so-called Secret Service 6 set is really well documented. And then I found all kinds of other stuff basically from there about the autopsy photos as such. So that plus the interviews that Harry Livingston did should bring actually quite an interesting read together. So hopefully I can start working on that next year.
Imagine how a doctor must felt. Their pension is on the line. They're under oath, and they're shown pictures that don't resemble what they saw. Imagine.
Well, I don't even go. I don't even want to go into that. I mean, Livingston did that really.
Yeah. But just imagine what they were feeling. Imagine you're sitting there, you're asked a question, and you know what you're looking at doesn't look the same, and you got to weigh your. Am I going to lose my pension if I give the wrong answer? So.
Well, it's the same thing with Mrs. Robert Reed inside the. Texas School Book Depository, when she claimed that she saw Oswald with a white T-shirt walk into the second floor office with a Coke and didn't mumble something. If you read Geneva,
hold on.
Okay. If you read Geneva Hines' testimony, first of all, you've got the Warren Commission testimony and you've got the FBI statement. The FBI statement clearly states that from 25 past 12 till 25 minutes to 1, so that's 5 minutes plus assassination time, she was on her own inside the second floor office because she was meant to look after the phones. The only thing she mentioned was strange is that the phones went off. Yeah. If Oswald came down a minute and a half later or so, minute later, after him getting the coke and walking through and such, that of course contradicts it. But what's worse is the fact that when you look at the testimony of Geneva Hein, look at the tone, and she, in one way, in the first bit, basically says, yes, nobody was there. And then they say, could Mrs. Robert Reeder sit there? They were on opposing desks, okay? They were like basically right opposite each other as their desks were. Well, she basically starts oohing and aahing. And in the last half of the whole testimony, it just becomes apparent you don't want to throw your job away because I'll tell you what, if you, the supervisor, because Robert Reed was the supervisor in that office, she'll fire you right there and then. So she basically backtracked a little bit because originally she said that Reed came in with Molina and all the others 25 minutes after the shooting.
Well, it's a similar thing, but when you work for the government, the reason you accept the lower salary is because you got a good pension. And the idea that you're at the end of your career, you know, and suddenly now your pension's at risk, much less perhaps prosecution. But, I mean, can you imagine the fear these people felt?
Yeah, the guy's dead anyway. So, what, the president's dead.
Right. The man's dead.
Oswald's dead.
Right.
Who cares?
Right.
Get over it. Move on.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, so, but any questions? More? Nothing? Casey, come on, hit me.
Hey, I'll tell you what, I think this session was really a good session when we started off with Bill Simpich and then went with a lot of different questions and then came back with you, Bart. This is a super session. And I know we went over, but I'll tell you what, I think it's fantastic, and I want to thank everybody personally for at least attending this, and then all the research that you guys do, it's phenomenal. And again, I know we're 58 years going into 58 years of this murder, and it just keeps going on. And I may have to get a third wife.
I want to quit.
Well, we have a certain urgency because people are dying, and like what happened with the Baseball Hall of Fame is that was just a very high profile, but on a non-high profile, we're losing witnesses left and right.
Yeah.
And, the next couple of years, there's going to be no one else to talk to.
I tell you one thing, and because with this whole COVID thing, I don't see myself traveling at least for the next 6 months whatsoever. If you really want to chase something, go after the women of the Texas School Book Depository, because most of them are still alive. Mm. A lot of them are alive. I love that video of Patricia Ann Donaldson when Max Holland asks her, and she goes, and then the shots get flying over, and she looks like she stands in front of the Texas School Book Depository, but she looks at the Tel-Tex building and say the shots came over her head like that. And it's like, if you look really carefully, I'm not kidding, she's not like, oh, it's behind me, the Texas School Book Depository. No, it's over there from the Tel-Tex, just like that. So the women, because the women were all 18, 19, 20, 21, a lot of them were very young. So there's at least 4 or 5 left to interview. But I just don't know what their mental capacity is at this point, because I saw one on the Sixth Floor Museum who was quite very forgetful. Whether she's demented, I don't know, but she was very forgetful and started mixing things up. I don't blame that because, my God, if you talk to me about something, I'm 55 in May, to say something, you remember something from 40 years ago, I say, get the fuck out of here, man. It's like, I remember shit.
I remember stuff.
I wanted people to know that I got on the chat the photos of Odom, who I believe is Odom. He's walking with Carl Day. There's other pictures of Odom in the epilogue, and I put up the epilogue in Chapter 12. You guys can just copy and paste before we get off.
Awesome.
And just take it home with you.
Is Chapter 12 your update?
It's all updated. I updated every chapter. So everything's got new stuff in it. I'll probably, 10 years from now, I'll do it again.
But I'm done for a while. I had a great time doing it.
Well, you know,
I'm going to do a whole new book on disinformation because this page is so full of bullshit. Yeah.
Bill, it's Neil. Can I just on that disinformation? Can I just ask a couple of questions regarding what you were saying about Bob Barrett earlier on? Do you have any evidence at the moment that he was in Dealey Plaza early? There's obviously that photograph, the Allen photograph with Buddy Walters, the guy in the suit that's picking up a hull, allegedly.
Oh, the grass picture.
Yeah, there's the grass picture. And Barrett in an FBI report said that he didn't get to the TSBD until 1 o'clock.
That's right.
So, I mean, you know, obviously you're suspicious about this character now. Have you found anything that suggests that he was there earlier?
I would suggest that you turn to Mark Oakes's work on YouTube. He did a whole study of Barrett. And what I like the most about Barrett's thing is that Barrett was sent a memo about all this, and he signs the memo going, yes, I was there. And then when there's follow-up, Barrett goes, oh, no, that was a mistake. I was saying I was not there.
He denies it in Trask's book, actually. Yeah,
right.
Barrett denies it in Trask's book. Yeah.
So I got a list of 10 of Barrett's greatest whoppers. And when you get through the 10 whoppers, you have to come to the conclusion like I did, I think. You can't believe a word he said. As to whether it's him at the site or not, again, I think Mark Oakes does the best job on it. And it's still not definitive for me, but there's a lot of questions about this man, whether or not he was there. He'd like you to think he was there, so you'll spend the rest of your life trying to prove he was there when he was doing 10 other bad things. That's my problem with Barrett.
Okay, fair enough.
Well, guys, I want to throw this in here real quick before we wrap up. Well, actually, we've been wrapping up for a while, but every time we do one of these meetings, email goes out to everybody, let them know that the meeting's going on, that it's coming up. Please, anybody that you know that's, maybe not attached to that email, for that email, we've got up to 100 seats that we can put on, and we can always increase to more if we need to. But, you know, if it's anybody that, that you think that, is not on that list, it should show, it should, take part in one of these monthly meetings, please, by all means, forward that email to them because they'll be able to sign up for the meeting through Eventbrite. And, I always more the merrier. And, not only that, but we'll put this video up on YouTube and on our website after the meeting closes within, 24 hours, hopefully. But like I say, anybody that, wants to, pass the information along, please do so.
Can I just, just a quick question before we'll cut off?
Sure.
Do you got any contacts at UNT or like, are you able to get good scans of, because I'm, the William Allen photos, the resolution is just crap. And I want, there's certain details in certain film photographs that I want to, the guy behind the glass when Patricia Ann Donaldson and Lupa Whitaker and all that walking down the steps. And there's a guy in the glass and he's got like a sports shirt on, a white looking sports, since it's black and white photo, a white sports shirt on. And it's just in the background behind the glass. And I'd like to really get a detailed scan. I mean, do you guys have contacts there and so forth? I mean, I can email them, of course, and all that.
I've got an address for William Allen himself if he's still alive in Arkansas. And
he won't have his negatives.
Well, he does. He does. Ask him. That's what I'm suggesting. And you could invite him to join us. You know, who else cares about his work more than we do, after all?
True. Well, I tell you what, I know we're sitting on a treasure trove of information, trying to get it all put up on the website. I mean, it's a labor to put everything up, but we're working, as fast as we can get new stuff put up on the website. Like I say, we just put up new stuff from J. Gary Shaw this past week. So I will work on getting more photographs throughout the collections that we have and get those put up as quickly as we can.
Well, yeah. Anything Texas School Book Depository related I'm interested in. So, and high res, none of this 1,500 pixel bullshit. It's useless. It's of no use to me. I'll tell you another secret, and you'll be able to see stills. I've got a 5K version of the Wiegmann film, but the copy isn't as good as the copy Richards E. Sprague had. Sprague was a clever man who basically, went off the rails as well, but he cut the film. He bought a copy for, I think, $60 or something like that from, the Darnell film is basically copied and sent to about 5 or 6 different, news organizations. And one of them was able to sell a copy. So then they copied that again. And that copy was pretty good of Prayer Man. And he had a professional photographer basically take 3 frames, the best frames of that film. Because even though Wiegmann, that film is exciting, 95% of it is blurred. So no matter where, whether he's running down towards the knoll or even also the pans when twice he basically catches the front of the Texas Kubel Depository as such. That particular copy that I've got is, it's nice to look at in 5K. And when you look at the footage on main, is everybody waving to the camera, and close by, it's not a problem when it comes to the footage as such. But when, because he shot with a wide angle lens, 9, 10 or 11 millimeter. And so the distance, even if it's like more than 30 feet, which was roughly the distance from him by the time he stood in front of the depository, aren't really that good as such. But the stills I am using are better than anything else. So that will come out in my paper. I've basically nabbed the stills from.
He's dead, but his archive is in Western Massachusetts.
I contacted the one that originally had his stuff in New England, and I've been told that his stuff went to NARA and in Georgetown. And Georgetown has got all this correspondence, which Dennis Morissette managed to copy, and I got my hands on. But the actual film material supposedly went to NARA, and I had somebody go to NARA 4 years ago for me there and basically managed to get hold of the 5x4 negatives of those 3 stills that he had professionally reproduced as such. So, and they're pretty good. I mean, for what they are, because you're looking at about 5th or 6th generation, because that's another thing. Every generation, you just have so much loss of detail as such. It's the same with the Darnell film. The Darnell film's been copied, comes from SMU. I have no idea why, but it comes from SMU. And they gave the Sixth Floor Museum that's a first generation copy, and they gave a digital copy to the Sixth Floor Museum. But I asked for a still, but they wouldn't give that to me. Copyright, you can't do anything about it. So that's my dilemma. Look, that goddamn film, either of them, is just going to be the icing on the cake, and the whole deck of cards just falls apart, all right? And then you lot can all jump in and reap the rewards. Because the second you show that asshole standing on that fucking landing, it's game over, or game open, basically. Case wide open, as such. That's the thing. If you show that Oswald was 100% stands there, then what else is there to debate? Not much. Then it's done. A done deal. But hey, and I'll probably need to use artificial intelligence as well, sharpening techniques. You know, that's one thing that will have to be done, because both of them were shot with wide angle, so it's too far away, and blurring as well. So they will need de-blurring and sharpening with artificial intelligence. So if I get the film, I go to iTech. That's the thing. Basically use that. Sorry, Casey.
I was going to say, we probably need to connect you to Larry Rivera.
No. Never.
Never?
Never.
You don't like Larry?
No. I don't like his work. I've never met Larry, but I don't want to.
The work is not necessarily going to pass professional muster. That's the problem. No. He takes too many chances.
All that fakery bullshit and stitches from
Larry. Larry's another guy, but I don't agree.
I'm not into that at all. So.
Okay.
Thanks for the offer, though. Bye. I saw his interview he did with Roy Edward Lewis, and it was edited, and it was in a really noisy environment, in a cafe or something, And my, I said to my pal, Ed Ledoux, I said, gotta find Wyatt with Lewis. I'm so fucking pissed off with this interview. It's so shit. And since he's alive, let's talk to this guy. And we had about two or three conversations with him as such. And he already lightened up a little bit about things. But he should be able to say, like, who was standing there in that corner. Because Bill Frazier won't. Bill Frazier is still too scared to do it as such. And I don't blame him. I mean, anyone that says, like, yeah, well, Oswald stood next to me. I've been lying for 50-odd years. How is that going to come down? And then the world press is just basically going to be standing on your doorstep and go, hey, let's have a talk about that. And we'll never do that. It's better to keep quiet about that. So the only thing that can help is the picture, better picture. And the interrogation reports as such that basically point to that. Because there's a fair amount, basically, that says that. But to some people, that will never be enough. So, and then when the picture comes out, there'll still be people that say, that's not enough. So I look forward to being able to say, I've had enough. See you later. Man, Bill, you're up for that?
We hear you.
We
just
hear
put it all in a box and just say, forget it. God damn. Sometimes I'm absolutely sick of it. Just,
hell. Now, you know, 58 years ago, it would have been simple as hell just to say Oswald did it. Ain't going to happen, though.
Yeah. Well, many people still do. So, I mean, that's the one thing I just find in these forums. And Facebook especially, you know? Facebook.
Yep.
So there's the group. You know, the truth be told, that group, Facebook, on Facebook. Jim Hess and all these deniers. This art scum. It's unbelievable.
That's the fair play for JFK.
He wrote part of that as well.
Yeah, I got kicked off.
Yeah, fair play for JFK.
Yeah.
I had to go because I was blocking half the admins because I'd already run into them outside of that group. So I joined that group and they go, no, you got to unblock him and you got to unblock him. I'm like, never. Not in a million years. I'll tell you right now, my lists. I've got to actually look into my blocked list because I think I've got as many lone nuts as diluted CT is right opposite each other. The rows, I think, are about almost as long as each other, basically. They're equally long. It's that mad because, you know, on the CT side as well. God, some of these people. You know the one with the gas mask in Elgin 6, the window, the door open. It says, like, it's a gas mask. The guy holds a gas mask in the window. You know that bit?
I do.
Yeah? Well, it's just utter bollocks. Because if you think that's because you can't think from a 3D going into 2D. If you look, you see a hand holds the window. But there is a face, which is August Campbell's face, by the way, right behind it. And basically it looks like a mask. Yeah? Because you're going from a 3D, from a hand, and then something that's, I don't know, 15, 20, 30 feet behind it and blends into like almost like a gas mask.
Well, the problem is, you know, the Kennedy case has been treated as entertainment for a lot of people for a lot of years. And you can't do entertainment and investigation in the same breath. They're two different genres.
Yeah. Oh, well.
And then when you have disinformation thrown in by both people inside and outside the research community, that makes it particularly difficult.
Yeah. That's why it's best thing, you know, like Malcolm always said, every minute you spend on that shit, you're not researching. That was Malcolm. And I was like, yeah, that's true. That's so true. So I basically I wouldn't say I don't flame, but let's just say I dropped it by 95%. I just don't get involved anymore. I'm just like, yeah, whatever. You know, I just post the stuff and don't respond to anything anymore. It's like, yeah, whatever. See you later. So. And the only time I get involved is at the Dealey Plaza UK Facebook page because there's, you know, some idiots. And I've made it a ground rule. No lone nutters, but also no deluded CTs either. So they just get the boot immediately, anyone that comes up this stuff. Because, you know, everything's, what, almost 60 years on, still hammering on about the Zapruder film? Come on, you know, find some new ground, you know, for a change. It's too much to deal with that, you know, at this time. And there are other groups as well that still harp on about it. And no one is presenting anything new. So, but it was painted. That's one thing, that's for sure. So, a lot of people, yeah.
I mean the rare head?
The rare head, but also Kellerman and Greer's head. It's a really simple way to find out about that. All you have to do is take the picture and lighten it up, but not just once in Photoshop, 4 or 5 times. So if you have a picture, a photograph, yeah, and it's about density. So if you put a lot of light through a slide, for instance, yeah, because that's what it was of a film, so a slide, positive. If you throw a lot of light, at some point, everything will bleach out. It doesn't matter if it's black or not, it will bleach out. Now, if I were to get a label or a sticker, and I stick that on the transparency, and I again put a lot of light through that, then of course that light won't go through that sticker. However, if I use retouching ink, yeah, which is really simple stuff that you used to use on Cibachrome prints, and it comes in a nice little set, and you wet the brush, and you just paint. Now, paint comes in different densities when you basically paint that on that. It will never be a full-on cover as such. So once you start increasing the light coming through that image, and I'm talking like excessively coming through, that everything bleaches out, the faces, the leather, the car, this, that, and the other, and yet still, this patch on the back of the head is still covered. It's still covered in shit. So that mathematically makes absolutely no sense, because if I look at other darkened areas, yeah, and we know that JFK's hair was lighter in tone than Jackie's, okay? We know that. There's pictures. You can just put them next to each other and you go, what? Jackie's hair is lighter than JFK.
He was almost a redhead, yeah.
So you're basically looking at that and you pump so much light through in Photoshop and you just put another layer on top, and you just whack it on more and more and more. So everything bleaches out. And yet still, the places on the head, here and on Kellerman and on Greer, they still cover. But you can see that at the edging, that it just breaks through because the paint isn't evenly applied. Because
why Kellerman and Greer? What's the significance of that?
To make it look in unison with the rest, with what is happening at the back of Kennedy's head. That's why. Any other black in that picture is bleached out, is completely obliterated with light, because that's what happens when you put so much light through. You're basically overexposed on top of overexposed on top of overexposed on top of overexposed. So it just blows out. And then yet, typically on the head here, there's nothing to see but a black painted blotch. And I used the high-res images that came with these documentaries, and I used 2 or 3 different documentaries because I thought, it's just a thing. You see, back then in the 60s, the stuff runs at normal speed through a projector, and there's no one paying attention to that whatsoever. But then you get digital imagery, which is much more detailed as such, and you basically go through it as such, and you look at it, and then you start whacking all that light through, then you've got a problem. I know nothing else about fakery on the Pruder film, but that is like, to me, the building 7 of the whole film, basically. It's just
building 7?
It's mathematically impossible where you just go like, no, there's no way in hell this is possible, because every other black is blasted away, yet the head, the hair, has got something on there that basically prevents from that bleaching out because of the overexposed. And I'm talking 5-6 times overexposed. I've bleached the lip. Oh, you know what? I'll get the pictures next time I talk. I'll throw that in as an encore, and you can look and you see for yourself. And then you'll go, that's not possible unless you put something on there, because the light doesn't come through. That's what I mean. You project light through an image. And if I put a sticker on there, there won't be coming any light through. If I paint on that, take the sticker off and paint on it, light will come through, but not like to the extent that everything else does. If you look at the front of the limousine, it's in the shadow because the light comes almost at there, 10, 11 o'clock, low, high. The shadow in the front completely disappeared. And I like brighten that picture up.
When COVID is over, Bart, you got to take the show on the road.
No kidding.
Conspiracy Weekly. Anyway, nice chatting to you guys. Thanks a lot.
Likewise.
Sorry I butted in, you know.
No, it was great.
Wow, very detaining and informative.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
All right, okay.
Well, as we're getting ready, just let everybody know that, this is going to be our next meeting. It's going to be March 20th, 2021, from 1 to 2:30 or later.
You may want to put an an estimated after then.
Yeah, we're just estimating the time. We call it an hour and a half, but hell, if it lasts 3 or 4 hours, it lasts as long. It takes, well, it's like the case. It's going to take as long as it takes.
Right.
So I just want to let everybody know that that's going to be the next meeting that we have. And then, like I say, again, April 30th and May 1st and 2nd is going to be the Spring JFK RFK MLK conference. So,
Bill Simpich, you on board with that?
I'm totally on board. Yeah.
What do you guys do in November?
In November, we're going to have another virtual conference. We're going to be the, I think what we did, since we did last year, we went the week before, Lancer and Baker's conference. So we're going to do the exact same thing. We'll have our conference the weekend before. And then, that way we're not competing. Plus we,
good idea.
You know, they always take that weekend. So, hey, I want to go the week. We want to go the weekend before. And that way, you know, people can, you know, attend ours and then see what the other two happen to look like. So, you know, there's plenty of dates on the calendar to have a conference. So,
and since people aren't traveling, you know, it's not hard to do it a week before, because that was always a problem. No one's going to travel twice in one week.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
Larry, you want to talk to?
I could. Let me circle with Bill and we'll, you know.
You got 55 minutes until Barney's got 55.
55 minutes?
No, you got to tell Barney's got 30, because that's going to turn out to be 55.
Got it. But I want him to talk, though. That's good, though.
That's right. 32 and a half. That's why.
No, you've got a lot of information we've been waiting to hear, Bart.
Yes, absolutely. We're just you know, joking.
Fun. I haven't even started yet.
David, can I just say a quick word? Can I just
thank
you, Casey, and Brian, the three amigos, for agreeing to talk at DPUK over the next few months. If you are interested, guys, they're doing the April, May, and June slots, I believe. And also, I'd like to thank you for linking to the DPUK website as well on the affiliated section of your website. Please, guys, take a look. I mean, the work that Bart has put in over the last few years is just tremendous. It really is.
Yeah, the value of making these documents online available, it's something that Bill and I have been talking about. You know, that's why we had Kappa do a program last year that Brian organized, but unfortunately, well, you know.
That's the most important thing, and I really hope people are starting to pick up on that. And instead of hoarding all that stuff at home, you just like find somebody. I mean, look at it. You know, you buy that scanner for $250. It's just an absolute joke. Because when you pump it, just look, and it's about double the amount in the UK, or the equivalent of it. But you just got to basically, especially the old timers, need to understand that, you know, we don't want your collection. We want to digitize your collection.
Right.
So that's a massive difference. Yeah. We'll borrow it for a few months or whatever, a year, and you get it all back, and they'll come to the opinion, go, oh, you got it all on one hard drive? Well, I'll have that instead. You know, I'm going to say, put the rest in the burner. See you later. But the bottom line is that the people need to understand that these papers need to be digitized and they need to be put online, because you're helping, you know, what you think is going to go to maybe 100 or 200 people. You know, we don't want to overestimate it.
The next generation may end up discovering
it.
This is not Babe Ruth's signature autograph you have. There's no real inherent value to them.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It's for the greater good.
Yeah, and you just share that freely.
The other thing about that is, guys, is how many times have we heard when researchers, you know, pass away that maybe it's a significant other, or, you know, somebody comes in to, you know, pack up the house and, well, you know, that's just, you know, too much shit they got to take care of. So they toss it, or it goes to the wind and you know, we lose it. So,
yeah,
you know.
Thing. I mean, I've heard horror stories from, what's her name, Lynn Mangan, the RFK researcher. She put it in a university. I forgot the name. And once it was put there, she couldn't even access it. So William Law told me that. And I was like, that's unbelievable. And I was like, it's just an absolute joke. On top of that, when you send it off to a university, it goes in the basement for God knows how long until they finally find the resources, money, or willpower to actually start digitizing it.
Right.
And the time is now. It's not 5 years from now. It's now.
Right.
Now.
Exactly right.
Well, that's what we experienced with. I spoke at CAPA back in 2018, and told everybody what we were doing with starting to digitize collections. And Dick Russell came up to us and said, you know, Baylor University, great university, but they've held on to my collection for 10 years and it's never even been put online yet. It's not even been digitized. It's just been sitting there. Yeah, in acid, acid free boxes and folders, and it's sitting there in a controlled environment, but it's so damn controlled that nobody can see it. So, yeah. He released it to where we could get a hold of it.
Wow.
And now we're actually getting, his collection put into digitized form and then get it up on the website so people can research it.
Does he have also the documents and pictures that have been digitized? They were digitized 15 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and they're all done at a lower resolution and so forth. So that's not, the thing is the internet, and for the research, you require bigger pictures, more higher resolution and so forth. Like, a good example that suffers from that is Post Library, the Armstrong Collection. What's his name? Brigadier General, Penn Jones, things like that. It's all, Jack White. Jack White's pictures are, it's big. And I was like, what the fuck am I going to do with that? It's like, it's absolutely useless.
Yeah.
I want a 4K scan, just quit fucking around. It's just unbelievable.
David, or does Dick Russell have his interview notes also?
We're still going through the boxes right now as we're digitizing.
Have you got Elsewhere stuff?
No.
That I want.
Okay. And that's another thing for people. If you have, let's just say that you have a scanner or you can get it scanned or you can get it to us and we can scan it. That's the whole point of bringing everything together, making the Prodigy FK website the central hub. So that way we can put collections online. We don't care if it's one page or 400,000, 4 million pages. The documents and the information, no matter how big or how small, need to get out there to the research community. That's where we come in. We're not making anything off of this. We're doing it to, help the research community and future generations of researchers be able to access what everybody has in their collections.
It comes down to bypassing the institutions that have actually this material.
That's right. No
different than, say, technology is bypassing old institutions and make it freely available. And then these institutions say, hold on a minute. They're bypassing us. They're giving everything out freely at high resolution and so forth. Web space doesn't cost as much as it did 10 years ago and so forth.
Right.
And therefore, they say, okay, let's join the party as such. You can basically start a movement of some sort that basically other people start to understand.
Yale University has just signed on to Mary Farrell, for example.
Who?
Yale University. We already had Princeton. Now we got Yale.
Wow.
We got good shit.
We got good shit. But yeah, that's the way forward. But the quicker the better. That's the whole thing. Because I don't want
to. Speaking of like high resolution, when we went to J. Gary Shaw's place and started going through looking at, first or second generation scans or slides. And I went out and not to throw out another scanner to go out and try to find, Bart, but the Epson, I think it's the
V600.
I know. I think it's called the Epson V600. Now, what it is, it's a photo flatbed scanner. It not only does documents and photos, but it comes with the actual trays that you can run, negatives, big, small.
Oh, wow.
You can run film strips through it, so it's got a scanner light at the top and on the actual plate on the planner. But what's nice about that is if you go on to the website and look up J. Gary Shaw's Legacy tab, the first one, you'll see slides that come in at 48-bit color. Let's see, it's 48-bit, 3200 DPI. And you're talking about a small little, 35 mil.
How big is the file?
How
big is the file?
Each individual photograph runs anywhere between, 30 to 50 megabytes per slide.
I've got a really shit box of film scanner because I'm a photographer. So I've bought this almost 20 years ago, and I'll tell you what, on eBay, it still goes for the same price that I purchased it.
Yeah.
It's a Nikon CoolScan LS9000. So, and it's a very good, it's an amazing scanner. It does everything at 4K right away there and then. And 35 mil, if I do it at 16 bits, it'll come like 60, 70 MB. If I do 120, if I do that at 16, it's a gig big right away there and then.
Yeah.
So if you take medium format slides, because, you know, I just want to get the best quality because sometimes I shoot on film and then submit it digitally to them. So, which is for me is one of the best things to do.
Definitely check out the, if you haven't seen the Shaw collection slides, like Willis and Reed and you know, definitely go on the website and look at how clear those slides came out, because there's even 35 millimeter black and white negatives that we took and digitized those as well in the same resolution. Compared to what we have and what everybody else has on their website, you Google something, you look at those images compared to what we have on ours, it's like night and day difference. You're looking at something that, you know, you see today's, you know, high definition compared to the mud as what we had back in the...
It's one of the when I started going into Prayer Man and all that, I downloaded from a Russian torrent site all the JFK documentaries in 720 and 1080, and that was, you know, 5 years ago, and it was like the biggest thing, because nowhere in Europe or in the US nobody was housing this stuff. So I was like, right, I'll go to the Russians, of course they've got it, and I downloaded it, and then I used screen capture software and basically play the films, and I had the screen capture software and take every frame, bam, 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 bam. So, you know, over a few minutes you just have a few thousand screenshots as such, and then basically start looking at it and stuff like that, you know.
Well,
I want to get my hands on it.
I guarantee that.
That's what I want to get my hands on. So the SMU apparently has a shit hot collection. They have all the WFAA reels and so forth. I don't. You see, I've been hunting the Darnell and the Beekman films, and the copy that I've got, I came across by sheer accident because I had Ian Griggs's collection as well, and I found a VHS tape. And when I looked at the VHS tape, I was like, the quality is really good. And when I contacted the company, they went, oh, we've got the newsreel. And I was like, you what? I thought you'd give me a DVD. And I was like, okay, I'll do work with that. And they went, no, we've got a newsreel copy. And I was like, huh, yeah, I'll have that. And he said, well, how big can you do it? You know, we can do it in 5K. I said, yeah, give me that. It cost me $800. It cost me $800, but I was like, yeah, I'll have that. So, you know, like I said, the stills are going to be in the paper. But, yeah, I know that SMU has apparently a really good stuff. Gary Mack, I've been hunting all that down as well, because Gary Mack used to work for WBAP.
Huh.
And those films, there's a news segment, I think I've got it on my site somewhere, and there's a news segment where he goes in the bowels of WBAP, which is NBC5 now, and those reels were just lying in cardboard boxes on shelves. Yeah, it's not like, oh, well, it's a relatively cool area, blah, blah, blah. So he gets all these reels out. And then I started to get in touch and try to find out what had happened to these reels. I even spoke to the vice president of the whole thing there. And I kept getting the runaround. I got the runaround from the sixth floor. I got the runaround because that was, I did it just after Gary Mack died. And they got the runaround from the Sixth Floor Museum. I got a runaround from the UNT, and I got the runaround from NBC5. And I just went like, I can't figure anything out. And then all of a sudden they said, yeah, we've given the films to UNT because they're digitizing them. So they're digitizing everything. And I'll tell you a great story about this. So they're digitizing everything. And they say, okay, all the newsreels from those days, we're going to digitize in 4K.
Wow.
Beautiful, crisp quality when you look. If you go to the UNT site, it's all there. And then I find an interview from the WBAP Times with Jimmy Darnell. And Jimmy Darnell doesn't even realize, and this shows you about memory and witnesses, Jimmy Darnell is not looking at his film. He's looking at Wiegmann's film and says, yeah, that's me running down Elm. Which he didn't, because he went on the left-hand side. He walked over the grass. He ran over the grass, then he took the pictures off the knoll with the press pass passing in front of him and so forth. So he was on the grass where Aldrin stood, roughly there, whereas Wiegmann ran on the pavement on the right-hand side and basically ran down and filmed the Hesters and so forth. So there's Darnell going like, saying like, this is my film and I'm running down the stairs, running down Elm. And it was just completely the opposite. It was just basically Wiegmann, because I just compared that footage with the Wiegmann film, and it was just abundantly clear that he was looking at the wrong film. But that's memory playing with you, of course. It's like, well, did you walk left? Did you walk right? Blah, blah, blah. So, you know, this detail. But then I went, and I asked him about the Darnell film. So all of a sudden, it's like, they've got Wiegmann, because Wiegmann is the biggest mystery of all, because Wiegmann was sold to other companies. But the story goes that Wiegmann and Darnell were flown to New York at NBC headquarters to disappear. And NBC is probably about one of the worst cooperators when it comes to, like, we want footage, can you help us, this, that, and the other. We asked, we emailed, Ed Ledoux emailed Megan something at NBC Universal, and she came back and she said, clearly, the powers that be do not allow us to give you the film or a digital copy of it as such. So I was so surprised when they had the first generation copy at SMU, and all of a sudden, bang, it just appears. Whereas I know from Gary Mack, they had that movie already 10 years in their safe already. They knew about it. They had a first generation copy. Mack admitted that on two emails. So I've got the emails there from like from 10 years ago, if not more, where he basically says, no, we've got it. We just have to worry about copyright, this, that, and the other. But you know what? The whole Prayer Man thing came off. And then they started hiding it.
Okay.
Go on.
I was going to say, is that the original Darnell film? Or is that the...
SNU has only a first-generation copy.
And you said that North...
The original was flown to New York. That's the story. The legend. As the legend goes.
Okay.
They were flown to New York. So, but, you know, Couch, for instance, ABC gave it to... CNN had it, like, there's this documentary called The 60s, and one of those episodes was about the Kennedy assassination. And the Couch film was easily handed over for digitization. And, well, they showed a 720 at that time because, you know, the documentary is from 12 to 15 years ago as such. I mean, now everybody wants 4K at least. I want 8K, but at least the standard is now, like, people say, oh, I only get 4K as such. So, but... It won't be long. It'll come out. And it'll be the icing on the cake. And then that's that. I can worry about the autopsy.
Well, again, guys, I think we're going to wrap up this month's meeting. And I hope to see everybody back again next month. And, hey, bring your friends. Tell your friends. And definitely, like I say, if getting back to the stuff we talked about, anything you want to bring and give to us to put up on the site as a blog entry, stuff you're working on, stuff you want to get out there for people to find out about, send it to us and let us get it put up there for you. So other than that, I want to thank everybody again, and we'll see you next month.
All right.
Thanks, David. Casey, take it
off. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.